go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing, and it is cussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility, an ongoing inquiry into American political origins and evolving institutions. The Executive Director of the Virtual Center is Dr. Bill O'Brien. He's also your host for this conversation. Here he is now, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Thank you, Bob Kincaid, and welcome to today's edition of the Virtual Center for the Study of the U.S. Constitution and Civic Responsibility. It is a pleasure to be with you on this, the 27th day of January in the year 2014. It is a Monday right now here in Appalachia. The sun is shining, and we are in the throes of quite a drop in temperature. This morning at 6:30, it was 41 degrees here in Beckley. Last time I looked, which is about an hour and a half ago, it was 23 here in Beckley. And the predictions are that we'll be down to something in the area of 3 to 5 below this evening. Tomorrow, the high temperature is supposed to be 9 degrees. And then tomorrow night, 6 to 8 below zero. So here we go again. You know, the irony of this is that as you go through it each time, it becomes a little bit less daunting than it was the first time. I think a lot of people were really scared the first time. And now with this one coming, maybe it's the fact that the prediction is that we're going to finally break out of this at the end of this week, beginning on Thursday. But we'll see. I know that this is one of those huge cold snaps, the jet stream going all the way down into Texas and Florida. And so the entire eastern part of the United States is experiencing this. So this is one incredible January. I was thinking as we were waiting to go on the air here that it was less than a month ago, as we approached the end of 2013, that I was hearing more than one person say, boy, I'm glad 2013's over. I can't wait to start a new year. This year, for whatever reason, whether they be personal or not, has been terrible. Well, I'm feeling the same way about the month of January. And the 1st of February is Sunday, is this coming Sunday. And I can't wait. This, in many ways, may be the longest month I've ever experienced in my life, and I know other people agree with me as well. It is a pleasure to be with you today. I don't know that you need that particular weather forecast. You can get them everywhere. But I am excited because it is Monday, and we are going to spend a couple of hours together here at the Virtual Center, and I look forward to it each and every single time. We would love to hear from you. I want to touch on a few things related to our programs last week before we get into something a little bit different today, but I think it's a logical extension of what we've been talking about. So anyway, with that, let me make sure that you have the phone number, and let me encourage you to pick up the phone and call us and share your ideas and your thinking on some of these issues. Received an email, a couple of emails, in fact. One of them will be in the topic today. I'd like to spend at least time today and probably tomorrow looking at the Common Core standards in education, what's happening and the concerns about them. It's creating more and more noise, if you will, among both right, you know, on both the right and the left. So I think the issue is well worth some attention. And one of the emailers alerted me to a piece, which I printed off, and it'll be a part of our program here on the Common Core. The other email I received is from Scott in Sweden. And he was making reference to the programs last week about the private sector collection of personal information of customers and people generally. And basically made the point that this is one that really is very, very serious and warrants the attention that we've been giving it. We gave it our full attention last week during all
child. I have been since, I guess I was about 9 years old when that first
started. I mean, this is the newest version of science fiction, which is the idea of computers replacing human beings in terms of the ability to think cognitively and do analysis and to compile and assess and synthesize data and all the rest of it. So I think the issue of artificial intelligence fits very, very well into this. Also, I looked at an email in the Washington Post about a week, 10 days ago, dealing with smartphones and some research that's been done, which indicates that so few people proportionally are taking advantage of what smartphones are able to do. And of course, it's a throwback to the idea of computers themselves. You know, much of the data over the last several years suggests that for most of us who own computers, work on computers, you know, kind of live on computers in a lot of ways, we're probably only using 10 to 15% of the capability of the technology. And it kind of suggests that there's a small group of people that is maximizing the technology and the use of the technology and the implications for what it can do. And they're the ones that we've been talking about that perhaps are making the innovations in technology which are causing change faster and faster. And for the decrease at such a rate, that very, very is the fact that so few of us, even now, are able to take advantage of the capability of the very technology that we use all the time. Anyway, our phone number, I want to try to make it a point to repeat it a couple of times during today's program. Area code 304-658-33-658. If you'd like to communicate your ideas and your thoughts on some of these subjects directly to me, my email address is waobrien906@gmail.com. That's waobrien906, all one word, O'Brien is I-E-N, 906@gmail.com. Already made a few references to the idea of artificial intelligence and a number of other things that have happening. I think we last time jobs and unemployment and the extent to which the information communication revolution that we find ourselves in and the technology that's driving it seems to be rendering more and more of our population unemployable, not just unemployed but unemployable. Because whereas, and I know we've talked about this before, and I think it's just good to kind of bring it to the surface and remind us of this. The article we looked at that addressed the issue of the differences between the so-called, made the point that what makes this so-called first industrial revolution, the industrial revolution itself, was that while there is all sorts of evidence of what the economists call creative destruction, the idea was resulting in the fact that a number of jobs were being eliminated as think cognitively and control the power, the technological power that was being developed. So in a sense, as creative destruction was happening, as jobs were being eliminated, new jobs were being created. And so the result was that unemployment didn't necessarily mean anything like, except for the very few, unemployable, because for the most part, new jobs that were being created by the very forces that were eliminating the old jobs. Is that because of the technological change, the degree of change, and the compounding of the degree. And I think one of the authors we looked at made the point that the difference is that when we talk about change now, we're not talking about change piling on top of what was in order to create something new. We're talking about change happening at an accelerating rate to the point that we're experiencing what some people would call revolution every couple of years. The degree of change is so great. The result is that the pressure on people, on human beings, to keep up with that in order to remain employable becomes less and less likely, more and more impossible. Consequently, it seems, and this is really, I think, the heart of what we were talking about, is that many people are finding when the jobs that they have been doing are eliminated by technology, the fact of the matter is that the technology is creating demands for new skills that fewer and fewer of our people have. And consequently, the likelihood of these people getting jobs equal to or even better than the jobs that they have lost is becoming less and less likely. So, it seems to me this is one of the things that we really need to. I've been playing with the computer here, and I got myself into a little bit of a bind, but I'll be okay. The result is, or the problem is that we are creating a situation which is making it more and more likely that fewer and fewer of us are going to be able to keep up. The technology is changing and moving forward so rapidly. The result is that as we concluded last week, much of the inequality that is happening, of course the focus has been on the United States, but inequality in the West generally has become more and more pronounced as fewer and fewer people are doing better and better while more and more people are doing worse and worse. And the result is that the inequality that everyone is talking about is being exacerbated, is being enhanced by what's happening in the realm of technology. So, consequently, I think we are confronted with a problem. And one of the things that we looked at in one of the pieces last week that we addressed was the issue of upgrading our education system. I think Tom Friedman suggested this in the conclusion of his column about it will take a hammer, is streamlining and upgrading our education system in order to have a better chance of providing the kinds of skills that people need and will need in order to remain employable. And that leads logically into the pressures that are underway right now to upgrade and reform specifically what is being referred to as the application or the introduction of so-called Common Core standards in each state. At this point, 46 states have bought into the so-called Common Core standards, as well as Washington, D.C. So the fact of the matter is, almost overnight, relatively speaking, not in a matter of years, but in a matter of months, the Common Core standards have kind of, because the implication is that these standards
other productivity and higher profit by taking care of their workers than by having a highly involved management style. And we offer that as an organization with Restaurant Opportunity Centers.
We stand today not because we want more money. We want justice today.
It's always the same story, even back when I started, 76. Less men, more coal. That's what they want.
I'm fighting for everyone in my community. I live in the south side of Chicago. It's rough. We all need to come together. Workers all around the nation.
Support Workers Independent News and keep these worker voices on the air by donating now at laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org. And I think it's going to be awakening to us, because just like the schools, when we cut the funding for schools, now we put it back in the budget, so they really didn't get cut. But I think now schools are starting to step up to the plate and look how they can maybe partner with private people to bring education, like, better into the schools.
Inequality, I just ignore. Don't know what a golden rule is for. But I do know a thing or two. And if all the states were red, no blue, what a wonderful world this would be.
Yeah, you hear a state representative like Sue Helms say something like that. Oh, we took the money out, but we put it all right back. You know, it's all there. We put it back. Trust us. Trust us. We put it all back. Yes, it's all there. Trust us. No, it's not. Trust me. It's not. And what's interesting to me is our governor, and the rumors that I'm hearing, the governor is going to steal from the pensions, the pension contribution he should be making, much like his predecessors of the past, and not make the contributions to the pension fund, making the problems there worse, and putting a dabble bit more into education, because it's an election year. You gotta make it, you gotta make the case that we really care about the children. We love the children. Especially when they're there for photo ops. Or to clean your toilets. You know, like Newt Gingrich wanted. Now the reality is we gotta get rid of people like Sue Helm, who is one of the 18 co-sponsors to this poison being pushed by Representative Brian Cutler and his ilk, and my representative, Stephen Bloom, this attack on workers under the guise of, oh, we're protecting people's paychecks. Yet when you really look between the, when you look at the words, there's no protection there. It's a ripoff. And I am so happy to see that someone is running against Brian Cutler in the 100th legislative district. But that's why I have asked Jay Rizzo Mertz to come talk with us about his campaign. Rizzo, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, thank you for having me on, Rick.
You know, good on you. Thank goodness somebody stepped forward and said, you know what, we're going to hold this guy accountable, at least to make him explain himself.
Oh, absolutely. That's the name of the game right now, is to hold Mr. Cutler accountable for his actions. He's run unopposed far too long, and it's about someone like myself throw their hat into the ring.
Now, if more people want information on your campaign, electjrizzomerch.com. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Rizzo's name. It'll take you right there. Let's talk about the campaign. What's the vision? What do you want to do first before we go and tear him apart? Because not very hard doing that. What do you want to do when you get there?
I want to basically take state government, make it centric on the people. For far too long, you were saying with your predecessors, with the pension issue, along with other issues, we've just been seeing these things be kicked down the road for years and years and years. And now my generation is being saddled with just so much struggle, and no one seems to want to have these conversations about what they're doing to members of my generation. Now, in 5 days, I'm turning 27. My age has nothing to do with my ability, because I'm quite motivated to serve. I come from a working class family. I completely understand what it means to struggle. And it's about time someone actually has real life experience, and not have experience with basically living either in some sort of an ivory tower or alternate dimension, which apparently some of these current representatives and our governor seem to be living in. And what I want to do is just take it back to the people and basically make it easy for people to succeed as much as the government can possibly do that. We see them make it easy for big business to succeed. And for far too long, we haven't had any conversation where, how can we help the people? How can we help the average Joe, the average Jane out there in the communities who are struggling, who can't seem to make their ends meet, and then have their very way of life attacked and demonized and scapegoated for political points. And I'm done with it. So I want to have those hard conversations. Every single day, I'm talking to individuals out in the communities, and it's time where we have a fresh approach and fresh faces and fresh blood come in to the system and just raise up all the ills and all the nastiness that we see, and just raise the standard. It does not have to be as awful as we're seeing it. It can be a new dawn and a new era, and that's what I want to be a part of.
Well, I like what I'm hearing here, but here's the thing. I look at the thing that has brought Cutler, I think, to most people's attention. This piece of poison that brought several thousand people out to the Capitol in Harrisburg on Tuesday, under the euphemistic name of paycheck protection. Yet I can find no protection. I do see a theft of rights, but I don't see much in the way of protection. What are you hearing from people in your district? Because, you know, Cutler's saying that this is something that his constituents want. I talked with John Micek last night, and according to Micek, Cutler is saying that, you know, this isn't part of ALEC, this isn't part of Freedom Works, this isn't part of the Koch Brothers Americans for Prosperity. This is something that people in your district, Rizzo, this is stuff that they want.
And I can see that's fundamentally not true. If he's saying that people in this district want, I have yet to come across an individual personally that feels that they were supportive. And it's actually the exact opposite is what I'm hearing. I spoke to a future constituent of mine. I'll be optimistic. I'm planning on winning this thing. And he informed me he's part of a trade union in the district. And him and his brethren are absolutely adamantly opposed to anything of this sort of legislation for the mere fact that it's a means to an end. It's not. It's exactly what happened in Wisconsin and Michigan. It's just the first step in Republicans' attempt to basically break the backs of the unions. And it does indeed attack the rights of individuals in the workplace to freely organize and to freely bargain for a fair wage, a fair benefits, and for safe working conditions. And any legislation that attacks fundamental rights of workers, I am adamantly opposed to, and I will fight against House Bill 1507 with everything I have, because it is definitely not what the people in this district, and it's certainly not what people in Pennsylvania are looking for. And if you do come across someone who says they maybe would support this, they just don't know the facts. And I'm here to make sure that I give them all the facts.
Well, it's obvious that, you know, in conversations I've had with reporters and folks, it's obvious he doesn't understand the facts, which is what scares me, is because this is a guy who's a lawmaker. This is somebody who is in a position of extreme power, and ignorance and ideology seem to be more the call of the day than actual thoughtful deliberation and careful legislating.
Correct. Yeah, that's all it is. It's pure ideological attempt of basically enabling corporate interests. Like when we saw for tweaking of the prevailing wage and things of that nature, that's just, in my mind, that's another way for Republican lawmakers or Republican business people or what have you to reward their buddies in the private sector or what have you. It does nothing but weaken private and public sector unions. It's just a means to an end, and it's certainly the end result is something that we're not going to want to see, because it's going to weaken the ability of workers here in Pennsylvania, like I was saying earlier, to freely organize and freely bargain for what they think is fair. Everyone deserves a fair wage for their labor, and that's something I'm going to fight for.
And I'm happy to hear that, because, you know, right now what we're seeing, not just here in Pennsylvania, but all across the country, is an assault on workers' rights, is an assault on the last group who really has a voice in this country. I fear that once the right and the Cutlers of the world and the Denglingers and the Metcalfs and all of their ilk, once they've accomplished what the Koch brothers and the rest want, yeah. There's no voice for people like you and me. There's no ability to stand up and fight. There's just subservience.
Absolutely. And it boils down to a simple choice, really. Do we want moneyed interests in this country and within Pennsylvania to call the shots and to be the ultimate forces behind our own destiny? Or do we want ourselves, the power of the people, to be the determining factor for our own destinies, be it in our communities, in our workplaces, in our daily lives? That is a simple choice that we face. And all day, every day, I will say anything that empowers the people is certainly something I'm going to get behind, because you're absolutely right, Rick. This is, you know, it's nothing but moneyed interest to basically game the system, to gum up the works and what have you, and hijack the democratic process and basically make it an appendage, make the government their own personal appendage, you know, to do with what they want and be the personal plaything. And it's going to basically not only destroy workers' rights, it's going to destroy democracy itself.
You know, it's one thing to be against Brian Cutler, and trust me, I am the poison that he is pushing. I don't know how you can be anything but viscerally sickened by what this guy is putting forth. The question then becomes is, what do we do? On education, I see him on the wrong side of things. On the Medicaid expansion, absolutely on the wrong side of things. So let me ask you, on the education front, you know, the governor and you got Sue Helm, who you heard the quote at the beginning saying, well, you know, we took some money out, but we put it all back. It's all there. But we need to have private people, private business in the schools, because there's this worldview that the only way things get done is through profiteers or the private sector coming to rescue us. And I fundamentally disagree with that.
Absolutely, as do I. As you're saying with Cutler being on the wrong side of education, like he could say with a straight face all he wants that he's for strong education system, what have you, but we just don't see that. He has voted for Governor Corbett's budget that basically included flat funding public higher education for $1 billion in cuts in basic education funding. And now what we're seeing, the governor backtracking on the funding formula that we had in place under Rendell that Democrats with him fought tooth and nail to instill. Now, once Corbett took office, him and his Republicans in Harrisburg abandoned that. Now, all of a sudden, we're hearing conversations that they want to basically go back and have conversations how we can institute a fair funding formula, what have you. So why all of a sudden is a funding formula a great idea? You know, it's nothing more than just political grandstanding. They're even going on with their school choice, things of that nature. It's nothing more than funneling public dollars into the hands of private interests. Now, charter schools and things of that nature, a lot of times, they aren't held to the same level of transparency and accountability that elected school boards and public school systems are held to. And the results that we see with any investment in private schools, we're not getting the return on our investments in any stretch of the imagination. We just don't see that. Where you find actual results in investments in education is ensuring that we are investing prudently in public schools. For over 200 years, we saw the rise of public schools, and we saw the United States build this great education system that sent men to the moon, that sent to the far reaches of the solar system. Now we're seeing a lot of these scientists, a lot of these astronomers, they are products of public education. I'm the product of public education myself, from K through 12 to my bachelor's degree at Millersville University. You can see great things from individuals if you invest in the students who attend public schools, and not by the basis of their zip code, but by having a fair and equitable funding formula where every child has a chance to succeed.
I'm right there with you. But, you know, I've asked numerous legislators over the last couple of years, explain how we fund our public schools, and none of them seem to have the same answer. It's scattershot, and more, it seems, who has the clout to get more for their area based on,
correct,
as you pointed out, the zip code.
Correct. Yeah, what we saw, I believe it was last year, certain school districts who had the luxury of having a member of the leadership in a general assembly, they got millions of additional dollars in funding for school districts that apparently are in their backyard. So you see a lot of these backroom deals in the absence of having a funding formula. So if we were to go back to the funding formula that Democrats and former Governor Rendell fought for, we can go back to building upon those successes that we see, where not by the basis of a zip code, we're seeing all of Pennsylvania's 500 school districts be able to afford the basic tools of success. updated textbooks, desks that don't break under the weight of students, buildings that aren't crumbling down around them. These are fundamental things that we aren't seeing in inner city school districts and rural school districts. Like, for example, I'll paint the stark picture that we see in Philadelphia, the school district there, where we saw massive closing, but just outside the city limits, we saw the construction of a $400 million prison complex. We could find $400 million for prisons, but we can't find $400 million for our public schools. How is that just? How is that fair? And that's what I want to do with my campaign, is raise those issues to the forefront and in the spotlight, and show that this doesn't have to, the status quo does not have to be how it is, that we can fight for the things that matter the most in our state and in our society, and not have to have them be scapegoated and demonized.
I'm right there with you. I mean, the reality is, you know, as you're laying this out, I'm thinking, you know, these aren't Democratic issues. These aren't Republican issues that you're laying out. These are just common sense issues. We shouldn't be spending $400 million on building a new private prison while our public schools are crumbling. But it does, if you look at it from the profit motive, Rizzo, if you look at it from who's the benefit, you know, cui bono, to whose benefit, it makes perfect sense. The profiteers only want heads in beds, and the best way to get heads in beds in the prisons is to defund the schools. There have been numerous studies out there that show you can predict by second grade how many kids in that class are going to end up in prison by just based on how prepared they are by second grade.
Correct. Yes, and we see that issue disproportionately affect minorities, African Americans, Hispanics, things. Those individuals, because a lot of times where we see these funding cuts disproportionately affect our inner city school districts, where they're not going to be predominantly white. And that's just a sad reality where these individuals are already kind of hindered by these misplaced rules in society that dictate, like, well, you can't succeed, you're African American, or you can't succeed, you're Hispanic. That is fundamentally just wrong, to think that just because someone on the basis of their skin color that they can't succeed. And then we make it even harder for them by tearing your public schools apart. And it's unconscionable how we see this. And then if you were to confront any of our current elected leaders about this, of course they're going to try to either deflect on the issue or say it's not some kind of blatant form of discrimination, but what else is it? It's just, I'm not at a loss as to explain what other possible motive it is, and to ensure that, you know, as you said, put heads in bed.
No, it is, and the privatized version of it. Last question I've got for you. You know, as you look at this, and you look at this is an uphill battle. I'm sure looking at the district that Cutler's in, and the challenge you have ahead of you. How can we help? Other than go to the website, elect J. Rizzo Mertz, which we've got a link at thericksmithshow.com, what can we do? What can folks do to help?
Well, one of the first promises I made when I set out on my campaign was I was not going to make myself beholden to corporate interests. I'm not going to approach corporate PACs. I want to steer clear of a lot of special interest groups that do business with corporations, things of that nature. So going along with that, I'm keeping my campaign, along with my vision, centered on the people. It's going to be completely people-powered, grassroots-powered. And so the individual stepping up and making whatever modest contribution they possibly can to my campaign will go a long way. Granted, personally, I abhor money in politics. But unfortunately, it's just the reality. You need it in order to challenge an individual such as Representative Cutler. And now, seeing that the forces that I'm going to be up against with the legislation he's putting forward, and just the forces that are going to be supporting him to make sure that he can succeed, I need the tools that I need to succeed. And people who want to spread the word of my campaign, who want to personally approach me either through my Facebook or through my website or through my email, what have you, just coming to me and lending their support, be it by word, by a contribution, or even, you know, I'm always looking for dedicated volunteers who want to lend their time and talents as well. I'm more than happy to speak of anybody who feels what I feel and is looking for what I'm looking for, any help whatsoever is greatly appreciated. And it just makes my campaign so much more strong and keeps my forward momentum building.
The website, Elect J. Rizzo Mertz. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on his name. It'll take you right there. You've got a friend here, Rizzo. We want you to come back here early and often to tell
Absolutely.
Us how things are going. And if you can, find those constituents who really want the paycheck deception that Cutler's pushing.
I'm looking. And I don't know if they're hiding under a rock or something like that, but I'm looking for them.
All right. I'd love to talk to them. Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We got a deal tonight. We got to do it today. No more madness to do. No more history. We got to deal tonight.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Let's turn now to the wide, wide, wild world of sports. The big story at this time of year, of course, is the Super Bowl. That multi-million dollar showcase of super-paid superstars, billionaire owners, taxpayer-financed sports palaces, extravagant corporate skyboxes serving deep-fried caviar, and TV ads running $4 million for a 30-second spot. But behind the scenes of this big-money sports extravaganza is a sordid secret of illegal cheating. No, not the use of steroids. Rather, this scandal is about the NFL's use and abuse of cheerleaders. Astonishingly, these glamorous, athletic, and very hard-working ladies, who bring sideline pizzazz to the show and are used by owners to promote the team brand and ticket sales, are paid less than the beer hawkers on game day, less than a McDonald's crew member, and way less than minimum wage. Yes, that's illegal, which is why some Raiderettes, the popular cheerleaders of Oakland's NFL team, have filed a lawsuit for wage theft against the owners. Overall, pro team cheerleaders get $70 to $90 per game. That's for a 12-hour game day plus uncompensated practice sessions that routinely run a grueling 6 hours and mandatory promotional appearances. The teams nickel and dime the women by shorting their hours, and they even illegally fine their pep leaders for such nonsense transgressions as bringing the wrong pom-pom to practice, and no health care for a job that puts you at constant risk of injury. And then there's this Dickensian twist. The club management withholds all cheerleader pay, as meager as it is, until the end of the season. So the women are essentially indentured servants to teams wallowing in wealth. This is Jim Hightower saying to the NFL, boo, boo.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Your working class radio experience.
Where hard work, common sense, and rational thought
are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
Working hard to make a left. Rich and from the red. Father shot that cameo. Blue dental had his vein. Oh, 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 he's a working class.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Check out our Facebook page, Twitter, all of that. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, the podcast there at the website, also Stitcher on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. So you see these places all across the country. Connecticut, just at the beginning of the year, said, we passed this paid sick day thing, and doesn't seem to really be costing anybody. All the predictions, the sky was going to fall, it was the end of the world. Not so much. In fact, a study done by Ruth Milkman and Eileen Applebaum said really nothing. In fact, there were a whole bunch of positives, like people actually staying in jobs, lower turnover rates. You look at places like Connecticut, like San Francisco and Seattle and Washington, D.C., who in the past have extended these. Last year, you had Jersey City, you had Portland, Oregon, New York City, all of these places saying, you know what, we want to extend a better community. We want to make sure that workers in our community get some level of protection if they get sick or if a family member gets sick. But not here in Pennsylvania. No, no, no. Our good Republican-led GOP General Assembly, led by Seth Grove, has put forth House Bill 1960, which would make it illegal for any municipality here in the Commonwealth to pass anything having to do with paid sick, anything, paid family leave, any of that stuff. So much for the party of family values. Amazing, amazing stuff. And look, at the end of this, it comes down to rights on the job. We see these attacks, much like we saw in Wisconsin and Michigan and Ohio. We're seeing them at every front. And we need somebody who's going to be on our side, somebody who's going to be willing to stand up and fight for us. And I came across this organization called Workplace Fairness. That's why I've asked their executive director, Paula Brantner, to come talk with us about workplace fairness, what the work they do, and how they can help us. Paula, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me, Rick. It's a pleasure.
You know, I see these attacks going on all across the country. 3 years ago, we were sleeping on the floor of the Capitol in Wisconsin saying, hey, Pennsylvania, get ready. This stuff is coming your way. We now see it's here. Workers are feeling overwhelmed. The assaults are coming from all directions. You know, what's a working person to do?
Well, you know, it's a difficult time to be a worker, and has been for some time. And we were hoping that as the economy improves, that workers would have a little bit more bargaining power and a little bit more clout in the workplace. And to the extent that's happening, employers don't want that to happen and are trying to beat that down and prevent workers from organizing and fighting back.
And, you know, I look at this paid sick day thing, and the studies are in. I mean, it's not as onerous and as cumbersome and as expensive as the anti-forces would have you believe, much like the minimum wage. They keep saying, oh, if we raise the minimum wage, millions of people are going to lose their jobs, and it will be the end of civilization. Yet none of that stuff ever seems to come to fruition. Why do we keep buying it?
You know, I'm not sure. And one thing about the study that I found interesting was that in Connecticut, 88.5% of employers already offered paid sick day coverage, which under the new law expanded to 93.7%. So really only 5% of workers were immediately impacted by this new law. So, you know, it obviously, you know, the sky didn't fall. The economy didn't collapse. But things are a lot better for those 5% of workers who before, you know, couldn't take time off when they were sick or their kids were sick and, you know, led to a lot of stress. It led to a lot of disease being spread in the workplace. Everyone's been at work with that person who coughs and spreads germs and, you know, infects the entire workplace. And no one wants to be in that situation. And so, you know, I don't know why any rational employer would oppose this, but yet they're still out there. And we still see it.
Could you make the argument that by passing these paid sick day laws, because that's a huge number, that 88% of the people were already doing the right thing. This just brought the other 5% in the line. Could you say that, you know, you're just shoring up the bottom and making sure that the good actors aren't punished by the bad actors?
Yeah. I mean, it's really the people affected by this. You know, most of us, you know, who are work for professional organizations, for nonprofit organizations, we already have those rights. And it's included within our job, most white-collar jobs, I would say, you know, have that and many blue-collar jobs as well. So those 5% of people are among the lowest paid, the most vulnerable. The people have the most to lose when they lose a day of work. You know, it's just an effort to basically, you know, keep those workers from having really any rights at all if they can help it.
Yeah, I look at this, Paula, and you know, the reality is what we've allowed to happen in this country is we've allowed these low wage employers, these low road employers, to dominate and to pull everybody else down with them. And I make the argument it's because we've allowed the assaults to continue on organized labor and on people's rights to join and form unions collectively and to bargain for better wages and hours and conditions. I think that, you know, that in a nutshell, that's it. Our ability to fight for the profits that we create having been taken away, I think that's why we see these situations the way they are.
Yeah, I mean, once you take union rights away, the only rights that workers have are those specifically guaranteed by law. And so, you know, it takes Connecticut to pass the specific law to make employers do the right thing. But in the absence of that, if workers aren't bargaining in the workplace for those benefits and the state law doesn't require it, then they just don't have it.
So,
you get some people doing it voluntarily, but, you know, again, it's people that have the most to lose that often don't have those rights.
So I look at Pennsylvania House Bill 1960, which, you know, 15 or 18 Republicans have co-sponsored, that would make it illegal for local municipalities, local townships, cities in the Commonwealth to pass, even one paid sick day per employee, anything. It would make it illegal. So as I'm looking at this scenario going on in my working life, when I started in the workforce, unionization was about 20% of the workforce were members of labor unions, now down to about 11%. All of those benefits that my grandparents' generation fought and bled for are being taken away, and now they want to take away the only other avenue, which is to pass laws. It just seems to me to be, a very concerted, well-thought-out, well-funded effort.
Well, we know a lot of these efforts are funded by the Koch brothers and other people who have a specific agenda that's anti-worker rights, anti-union. But, you know, I think it even goes further than that. They really don't want workers to have any rights at all. And they know that, you know, the lowest paid sector of the workforce, without a union is just simply in no position to bargain for any rights. They're worried about their hours being cut, and whether they're going to be allowed to work full time. There was all the concern about the Affordable Care Act that employers would be cutting their workers so they wouldn't be eligible for health care benefits. And so without a union, these workers really have nothing. And you see in all the efforts to fight the minimum wage, unemployment extensions, I mean, it's all this sector of people that they really don't want to have any rights at all.
You know, I go back to, you know, when we went to Wisconsin, and you see some of the video footage of Scott Walker meeting the billionaire Diane Hendricks, and, you know, her asking in the most warm and fuzzy and all tingly way, when will Wisconsin pass, right to work? And, you know, what is it that a billionaire, someone who could afford, and she's a billionaire a number of times over, could afford anything this planet has to offer? What is it about this one elusive prize in her jewelry box that she has to have and elicits this kind of a response from her? And I can only think it's the absolute and total control and power over all the rest of us.
That was exactly what I was going to say, Rick. It's, you know, the will to dominate and, you know, ensure that, you know, her will never be thwarted. It will not be thwarted by her workers. It will not be thwarted by the government.
Let me ask you this. You know, we've got President Obama running around the country. A couple of months ago, he was running around with Amazon and, you know, saying, this is the employer of the future. And I got to be honest, I've been into a number of Amazon's facilities. They're mostly staffed with temporary workers who work for third-party logistics companies for, you know, 10, 12 bucks an hour with no benefits and no hope of ever really becoming full-time employees. They're basically permanent temporary workers, permanent third-party temporary workers. And I got to ask, is this the future of the country, and is this how we build a middle class?
Well, it's certainly not, and I think, you know, Amazon learned a lot from its neighbor Microsoft, who was embroiled in litigation over the permatemp issue for close to a decade. Employers want maximum control over the workplace. They want to be able to lay people off and hire people just as they want to, and, you know, not report to a union or not be concerned about, you know, vesting rights, that sort of thing. You know, it's really unfortunate that, you know, you can work in the job for 3 years or 5 years or a decade and have no more rights and no more benefits than the first day you walked in the door. I mean, we all like to think the American dream is that, you know, when you get a job and you do good work, that you're going to advance in the workplace. But a lot of workplaces are specifically designed so that that cannot happen. And, you know, it's specifically discouraged because we don't want to pay long-time workers more benefits or more sick days or more vacation days or, you know, any other, you know, vesting of stock options.
Yeah, we've been led to believe that there's this thing called a meritocracy, that if you play hard, you play by the rules, you work hard, that you're going to get ahead. But sadly, for so many, that's not even remotely the possibility. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Paula Brantner. She's executive director of the group Workplace Fairness. Their website, workplacefairness.org. Their organization's mission, working to preserve and promote employee rights. Last line of questioning I've got for you on that. On that premise, you know, there are a lot of folks who think that we workers in this country have a whole bunch of rights. Sadly, you know, as I say on this program often, we're basically at will. We're at the will of someone, and if they don't want us here anymore, there's the door, unless they violate one of the, you know, the federal things, age, while they're kicking you out the door, say, get your old behind or your minority self out of here. There's not much we can do about it, is there?
Well, you know, it depends. You know, some areas have more rights than others, but, you know, it's really important to know what those rights are. I mean, you have rights if you're a whistleblower. You have a right to earn the wages that you've earned for doing work and not have wage theft. And you do have a right to be free from discrimination and harassment. Unfortunately, some of those things can be very difficult to prove, which is why it's really important to, you know, if you do encounter a problem at work, you know, it's just not something that most people think about. They think they're good employees and they're doing a good job and they don't have anything to worry about. And sometimes they really don't until new management comes in or they get a new supervisor and they start having problems that they never encountered before. You need to know what to do when that happens. And the Workplace Fairness website at workplacefairness.org covers virtually every area that could come up in your workplace, from discrimination and wage and hour and union rights and workers' comp and you're injured on the job. Anytime something bad happens, our website is there 24/7 and it's free, and you can find out if you have any rights in the situation. And we have a Find a Lawyer database where you can find a lawyer in your area who will talk to you and potentially represent you if you have the grounds to take legal action.
And here again, you know, all the things that you just said, as someone who was a Teamster for more than 20 years, all of those things came through my union. We had the ability to go talk to a lawyer free. We had the ability to have someone go and investigate our wage theft claims. And, you know, all of these euphemistic laws, the ALEC legislation that we're seeing, like here in Pennsylvania, they're pushing this euphemistically named paycheck protection. Yet it doesn't seem to protect anything. That doesn't protect against wage theft, hour and overtime theft. It doesn't protect against any of that. But you know, it's got a nice name, though.
Yeah, that's what we find with a lot of this anti-workers' rights legislation, like paycheck protection, like right to work. I mean, right to work sounds like a really good thing. Like, you should have a right to work, but that's not, it's the right to work for less. And they like to, you know, give these bills innocuous names, you know, in the hopes that workers won't figure out what they're really about and, you know, we'll think they sound reasonable when, in fact, they're not.
Yeah, anything but. I keep telling my labor friends that they've got to reclaim the right to work because it was originally a labor call that every worker should have a right to a job, a right to a decent wage, a right to be able to support their family. And somehow the big money special interests in this country have taken it over. And what people think is a right to a job really is, well, not.
Yeah, and, you know, that's just one of their techniques that, you know, you're too busy, you know, trying to maintain your job and your family life and balance your work and work and life. And you know, you've got other things to worry about. But, you know, remember the employer is often out there looking for ways to minimize what few rights you already have.
Yeah, absolutely. Paula Brantner, I appreciate you taking time for us, Executive Director of Workplace Fairness, their website, workplacefairness.org. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. I appreciate your time. I'd love to have you come back again some point in the future.
Love to, Rick. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Paula. Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
To the last of us, fight till we die. To the kings of the kingdom on high. All stand together for the world to see. Now the time is right to live out all our dreams. Say the word forever, your strength will never leave.
Show, where working people come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
We need to stand united, undivided, we shall never fall. Remember all, we need to trust in and then forever call on our brothers and our sisters. And are you and I aware? You and I both know that we can rely on it.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you've missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast that you're on the smartphone. So many things, so many opportunities. You know, I look at that and, you know, and Paul is right. I mean, there are a couple of rights, not many. Not much in the way of rights for folks, especially in this country. Now, as I've always said, the right to fold your arms is one of the big rights that we still have, and the right to say, no, not going to do it. But, you know, you look at this, and there's so many opportunities, so many things we need to be working on. That's why, you know, this week to me was such an amazing week with all of the activism and all of the opportunities to get engaged, to get involved. And, look, you know, like Jay Rizzo-Mertz and like Linda Small, who we'll talk to in the next hour, we need people who are going to step forward. We need people who are going to stand up and say, you know what, we're going to take on the entrenched special interests. We're going to go after the Stephen Blooms. We're going to go after the Daryl Metcalfs. And we're going to make them stand in front of their constituents. And we're going to make them accountable. I mean, think about that for a second. We're going to make them accountable. We're going to make them stand up and say, you know what, we pushed this poison and this is why. Because I got to tell you, I think when you start looking at the more rational, the more reasonable Republicans who said, you know what, we just want you to work on jobs. We just want you to work on stuff that matters to us. That's simple. Anyway, going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, I'm the talk.
This is why we fight, why we
radio for the rest of us. Rick Smith.
It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Illinois AFL-CIO President Mike Kerrigan says the lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of billions of dollars in pension cuts for Illinois public workers came only after years of efforts to negotiate a solution to the unfunded pension obligations. He says the unconstitutional theft of these earned contractually promised benefits is unacceptable.
Some of my quote used that word exactly, pension theft. So we're going to court, and we're confident this public act will be overturned.
Kerrigan says pension payments should have equal high priority to bond obligations, so workers who put in decades of work earning those pensions won't be shortchanged.
Pension payments need to have a high priority in terms of those kind of things get paid first before we have other discussions about spending money on other programs. This is an obligation as a result of contract negotiation, and they need to be honored.
Walmart workers sent an open letter to the new Walmart CEO urging him to work with Our Walmart to improve working conditions and wages for Walmart workers. They said in the letter that low pay, inadequate hours, and unpredictable scheduling isn't good for workers or for the business.
Martinez, and they wrote the new CEO about Barbara Collins, an 8-year employee of Walmart who was fired for speaking out about wages and working conditions. Collins had to visit 3 different food banks in 1 month to feed her family. The workers appealed to new CEO Doug McMillon to be responsive to efforts by workers to get Walmart to treat workers better.
Just because a worker is making money off of tables doesn't mean that the corporation should opt out of paying them decent wage.
Former restaurant worker Carlos Romero. Romero is high road organizer with the Restaurant Opportunities Centers in Chicago. Chicago community activists, including Stand Up Chicago, the Workers Organizing Committee of Chicago, SEIU, Action Now, and the Grassroots Collaborative this week pushed for a higher minimum wage in the city. The groups are backing a voter referendum on the March 18th ballot calling for a city minimum wage of $15 an hour. Romero says it's time that new models were adopted to end poverty wages for restaurant and other low-wage workers, and that should include paying living wages instead of tipped wages for restaurant workers.
There are multiple business models out there that show higher productivity and higher profit by taking care of their workers and by having a highly involved management style. And we offer that as an organization with Restaurant Opportunity Centers.
We stand today not because we want more money. We want justice today.
It's always the same story, even back when I started, 76. Less men, more coal. That's what they want.
I'm fighting for everyone. Everyone in my community. I live in the south side of Chicago, and it's rough. We all need to come together. Workers all around the nation.
Support Workers Independent News and keep these worker voices on the air by donating now at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Prevailing wage was actually discriminatory when it started. I don't think we need to go into the full history of that, but it was definitely meant to keep construction projects local. And we are now in pretty much of a global economy.
Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. That guy right there, he could be senator. He is running for the seat left vacant. And this is one of those moments where you go, really? You ran to fulfill a term to be a Pennsylvania state senator, but now you're going to go take the head job over at the farm show or the farm complex. Nice cushy gig, I guess, and basically stick the taxpayers. Now, there's a whole bunch of backroom dealings, whole bunch of stuff going on that, you know, not even I'm all on, but I know the guy you just heard there, who, you know, we live in a global economy, so you know what? We should have, you know, Chinese workers coming in, right? I mean, is that what he's talking about? This is the guy who is the chairman of the Labor and Industry Committee. All of the ugliness, all of the nonsense, all of the attacks on workers comes out of his committee. And now this guy wants to sit in the Pennsylvania State Senate. I got to tell you, I sure hope not, which is why I've asked Linda Small to come talk with us. She is running as a Democrat in the special election in York County's 28th State Senatorial District. Linda, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
You know, I listened to this guy, this Chairman Miller, Ron Miller, who's, I guess, running for the open seat, you know, as one of the more destructive people in our Commonwealth when it comes to workers' rights, this idea that he was on the forefront of going after the prevailing wage in the last round of transportation talks. To me, putting him in the Senate would be a horrible mistake.
Well, I agree. The interesting thing is he truly believes that he's creating a good business climate. And one of the reasons I'm running is because he's got the whole thing wrong. When you want to create a good business climate, you create a strong climate with strong unions. All the indicators for things unions fight for, sick leave, health care, good wages, that leads to more productivity. You can measure that. So
Safe working conditions, all of that stuff. And I've often made the argument that, you know, a good strong union movement in the country actually prevents businesses from harming themselves. Because, you know, they're looking to save as much, make as much money as they can, even if that means cutting corners and doing things that long term are injurious to the company's, own interests.
I agree. One of the things that I like to point out is that, Henry Ford was famous for wanting to pay his workers enough that they could buy his cars. Henry Ford was called a traitor to his class. Well, Henry Ford's business survives to this day. A lot of the people who called him a traitor to his class, their businesses are not here. So you've got the moral argument of the safety of the workers. You've got the economic argument. It just, you know, we need the strong unions, and my opponent has just got the wrong idea of what we need to do to make Pennsylvania strong, too.
I'm right there with you. But, you know, you see all of this money that's coming in, and I can't imagine, this is an uphill climb for sure. But the money that has perverted our politics, I can't imagine how badly you're going to be outspent here, especially as this primary moves forward.
Well, it's going to be very tough, and I tell you, in the special election, that was a special deal. And, of course, they're going to say it's not, but...
Explain that to me, because, you know, I saw the really rich guy down there who was running against Waugh to begin with, this Scott Wagner guy, I think his name is. He was complaining about it as well. Explain, what's going on?
But basically, explained that Senator Waugh originally said he was going to resign at the end of the year, but they've now found him the job as executive director at the farm show. So, you know, he resigns, and they set the special election for about 9 weeks afterward. When State Representative Eugene DePasquale resigned, a Democrat from York City, they took 18 weeks after his resignation and held the special election on the primary day, May 20th. This special election is going to be held on March 18th. That's going to cost taxpayers around $200,000, maybe more, maybe a little less, because that's the best way that they can maneuver and make sure that their hand-picked candidate has an advantage. As you know, any candidate would have a hard time getting a campaign together in 9 weeks,
right.
unless you happen to be, you know, a senior representative like Miller,
or a really really rich guy like Wagner.
Exactly, and it's just power politics. It's what makes people cynical about politics, because they tell you with a straight face it's not about them trying to get an advantage, but you know it certainly looks otherwise. As a matter of fact, Senator Scarnati said something to the effect of the fact that they have to deal with the pension reform and liquor reform, and they need somebody to support that. It almost sounds like they've got their bills ready, and they need that extra vote in there. They could wait till May 20th, as we well know. And I invite people to look and see that even Republicans in York County are calling them out for this kind of backroom deal.
Well, I mean, these are supposed to be the people who are fiscally responsible. They're supposed to be the stewards of the taxpayer's dollar. I mean, you know, most of my fiscally conservative friends, when they touch a quarter, the eagle screams. you know, I look at this, and that's anything but, you know, being fiscally responsible.
I will argue that I am much more fiscally responsible. If I'm spending money, taxpayer money, I want to get a return on it. And I'm not wasting $200,000 on an election and what was it, the money that the governor spent keeping the lottery privatization contract.
Yeah, $4 million last I saw.
Yeah, and you know, that starts adding up. And that's real dollars. You give, you know, a lot of the distressed school systems, you give $4 million there, you're returning teachers to the classroom. You're giving programs. We've had a lot of the programs cut and our school taxes increased. So, you know, stop telling us that you're the fiscally responsible ones when you waste money, when we could really be using it.
You know, I look at this, and you know, I'm encouraging every people in every district where the Republicans probably going to go unopposed to just go out there and make them make the case of why they deserve to still be in office. Given all the divisiveness, given all of the attacks, given really the gridlock that, you know, when you have steamroller power like the Republicans have in this state, when they have absolute and complete total control, and yet still we can't get a jobs plan, and it took almost forever to get a transportation plan, and we can't seem to get just basic, simple moments of governance done, there's a serious problem.
It is, and I think it comes down to their fundamental philosophical misunderstanding of, you know, what they want to be true and what really is true. For instance, they'll tell you as much as any Democrat that education is important, yet the governor and the Republicans have cut $1 billion, and they haven't really restored that money. And they'll do a kind of a little dance step to try to explain that, well, they did or they didn't, but there's less money in the schools. So we're cutting teachers. And, you know, they cut 20,000 teachers because of these budget cuts. Well, that's 20,000 jobs. You want to talk about jobs. Just fund schools. And they're doing that by giving things away to corporations. There's tax breaks in the last budget to companies like Verizon. I hadn't heard that Verizon really needed any help. In the news the other day, Comcast just got $40 million in grants from both the city and state to build a new skyscraper in right. Philadelphia. You know, small businesses are the true job creators. What small business can compete against a corporation that has $12 billion in profits getting taxpayer money? You know how many taxpayers it takes to make $30 million? You know, I'm not contributing a heck of a lot to that $30 million. There's a whole lot of us. I want my money to go to schools, to roads, not to Comcast. Comcast could just take a teeny little bit of their profit and do this. They talk about the free market. I believe in the free market. Let's have a free market. That's why I say I'm more fiscally responsible, I think, than the Republicans. I think they've become caricatures of themselves.
Yeah. What I find interesting is, you know, given what you just laid out with all the corporate welfare that we're giving out, they still focus on the single mother trying to put food on the table. They still focus on the unemployed worker who's struggling to find work because there's three people out there looking for every job. It seems to me that they spend more of their time looking backwards and down on people than they do on actually trying to solve problems.
That's exactly the case. When you look at the amount of welfare, like I said, it's so much more for the corporations. But it's easier to... It's easier to pick on the people without power. It's easier to say that unions are the problem. Unions have nothing to do with all these corporate tax breaks, and that's what's breaking the bank. That's why in our area we have a real problem with property taxes for the schools, because they're going up, because the state share of funding for education is down to near 34%. It needs to be up near 50%. We need corporations to pay their fair share. The corporations, the corporate tax rates have been going down. It's just, the math doesn't add up. Yet they keep telling us that we have to tighten our belt. We have to make the tough choices. And they'll criticize the school boards for raising taxes, but we have to educate our kids. I mean, it's simple math. It's simple. Step back, think about it. And like you said, stop blaming the people without power and stop blaming unions, stop going. One interesting thing I want to make sure I point out about my opponent is he co-sponsored a bill that says, that basically nullifies the Affordable Care Act. It says Pennsylvania will not do anything to implement the law. As you know, that's just not how the Constitution works. Federal law trumps our law. But on the other hand, while he wants to say, you know, states' rights there, he is a co-sponsor of this preemption bill that will block your local efforts to guarantee things like sick pay.
Yep.
So I don't know where he's trying to be philosophically, because what I see is he wants all the power in Harrisburg. Well, that's just not healthy.
Well, I think he wants to be in the Koch brothers' pockets. Is that where he wants to be? Because that's where all the money is. And then you got to wonder. You know, I heard over the Christmas break, the Koch brothers were in town, you know, making offers. Vote our way, and your coffers will be full. Vote against us, and we'll take you out.
Well, you know, that's the problem we have. I am very, one of my big issues is global warming. It is something that we have to act on. The science is downright scary. You look at what's happening in California, Hurricane Sandy, things like that. So I used to think that was the most important problem, but when you look at the root cause, it's the corporate power and it's the money power of people like the Koch brothers that can buy their influence. And they found they can buy and let state legislatures. It's a lot cheaper to buy your laws state by state because it's a cheaper race. It's, you know, a state Senate seat cost less to get than a congressional seat.
Oh, absolutely. And there are a lot less laws, especially here in Pennsylvania. So how can we help? Do you have a website we can go to? How do we get in contact with you? Tell me.
Okay, my website is just getting off the ground. It's www.small4pasenate.com. And on that page, I've got a donate. I've got my committee ready, so you can donate to Small for PA Senate at P.O. Box 1862, York, PA 17405. I've got my email contact there. I've got getting people to help me coordinate volunteers. We're gonna try as best we can. We're going to try to get phone banking going, as many people door knocking as we can. As you know, on a special election, because it's on an off day, it's March 18th, it comes down to turnout. And we really need Democrats and independents, Greens, who don't like to see corporations own our democracy. They need to come out and they need to vote for me.
Yeah, it's all about turning out the vote and getting people to pull the lever. And again, that's smallforpasenate.com. We'll get a link at thericksmithshow.com to help you get to that site. Linda, I would love to have you come back and talk to us again as your campaign heats up. Let me ask you, does this end at the primary? When does the WAW term end? Is this special election for, you know, till next this November, a year from November? When and will you run for that as well?
Yeah, the WAW already resigned, so this special election is to replace him. On March 18th, the 28th district chooses their state senator. Then
I understand that.
I'm petitioning for the primary, so I will run for the regular election.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. Because just because he left doesn't mean that seat automatically goes to another 4-year term, right?
Right, but the 4-year election happens to be this year.
Right, that's what
anyhow.
I was asking.
So yes, it's not it gets complicated, and that's just one other reason why they shouldn't, you know, they shouldn't run the democracy this way. If we had the special on May 20th, it'd be a lot less confusing. May 20th is primary date.
Yeah, when you're trying to rig the game, you do what you can. Linda Small, I appreciate the time. Again, smallforpasenate.com. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Linda, thanks so much. I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Rick.
Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Hear what I say. It's money that matters in the USA.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Let's turn now to the wide, wide, wild world of sports.
big story at this time of year, of course, is the Super Bowl. That multi-million dollar showcase of super-paid superstars, billionaire owners, taxpayer-financed sports palaces, extravagant corporate skyboxes serving deep-fried caviar, and TV ads running $4 million for a 30-second spot. But behind the scenes of this big-money sports extravaganza is a sordid secret of illegal cheating. No, not the use of steroids. Rather, this scandal is about the NFL's use and abuse of cheerleaders. Astonishingly, these glamorous, athletic, and very hard-working ladies, who bring sideline pizzazz to the show and are used by owners to promote the team brand and ticket sales, are paid less than the beer hawkers on game day, less than a McDonald's crew member, and way less than minimum wage. Yes, that's illegal. Which is why some Raiderettes, the popular cheerleaders of Oakland's NFL team, have filed a lawsuit for wage theft against the owners. Overall, pro team cheerleaders get $70 to $90 per game. That's for a 12-hour game day, plus uncompensated practice sessions that routinely run a grueling 6 hours, and mandatory promotional appearances. The teams nickel and dime the women by shorting their hours, and they even illegally fine their pep leaders for such nonsense transgressions as bringing the wrong pom-poms to practice, and no health care for a job that puts you at constant risk of injury. And then there's this Dickensian twist. The club management withholds all cheerleader pay, as meager as it is, until the end of the season. So the women are essentially indentured servants to teams wallowing in wealth. This is Jim Hightower saying to the NFL, boo, boo. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So, you know, I look at this, and good. I mean, there are a couple of people who are saying, you know, I'm going to throw my hat in the ring. I'm going to stand up and say, you know, explain yourself. And that's what our democracy really is about. That's what this whole process is about. This is why these are the kind of term limits I'm in favor of. The idea that, you know what, you're going to have to explain yourself at some level. And when I sit down and I think about this, and you sit down and you look at the people who are willing to stand up and say, you know, I'll take it, I'll do it. You got to give them credit. And now, this 28th senatorial district nonsense, this Mike Wall retiring. I remember at the beginning, at the end of the year, at the end of his, he just wasn't going to run for re-election. And that's what I was asking her. Is this is the special election just for this to take us to the end of the year? Because I wanted to highlight the waste of money. I mean, we're talking about an enormous amount of money for a very short period of time. Now, you know, you're going to have this special election in March. So, and there's part of me that goes, be careful, because the ugliness, all of the insanity and all of the ugliness that we expect could be coming to fruition. But I look at this and I go, you know, what happened to fiscally responsible? What happened to taking care of the taxpayer's dime? What happened to trust us? We know how to run a business. Explain to me a business that would do this. There isn't any. And this is very, very ideological. And look, I look at Ron Miller, I got to be honest, you know, probably is the inside favorite. You know, Linda's going to have an uphill battle because the money's against her. The entrenched party interests are against her. But you look at these characters, man, and I have no idea how people can hold their nose and vote for them. You know, someone like Miller who said, you know, and I listened to that press conference, and it was a while ago. where he was talking about prevailing wage and really kind of just had a thing for the prevailing wage. Got to destroy that. Why? So we can destroy wages. So we can bring wages down. That's what it's about. And this nonsensical view, and we've talked about this before a number of times, that if you lower people's wages, the cost of the projects are going to go down. That doesn't hold up to any scrutiny whatsoever. If you lower people's wages, that just means that the contractors will put more money in their pockets. And we've tried this, and we've seen other places that have tried doing away with prevailing wage and have tried exempting certain things from prevailing wage and tried changing the definitions. It comes down to one thing: lower wages for workers, less for us, more for them. And I think you have to start thinking in those terms. I really, and I hate thinking that way, but I think at some point you have to start thinking in those terms of, look, it really is an us and them situation. It really is, you know, we've got to be taking care of ourselves because they don't seem to really, really care all that much about us. And, you know, you kind of go back and listen to that comment, you know, because they love to say, you know, the building trades were all racist. They love to say that. And, you know, maybe some back in the day were. And maybe some places you have these things. But he hit on what prevailing wage is really about. It's about local. It's about making sure that you grow and you have a local building trades. That you have local craftsmen, that you have people locally who are building your businesses and building your schools, building your hospitals, because they're not going to do shoddy work. They're going to be right there. To me, it just seems absolutely no-brainer. But for Miller to say, you know, we live in a global economy. Yeah, we do live in a global economy. That doesn't mean I want to get construction workers from Bangladesh. It doesn't mean we should be bringing in people from Sri Lanka to put up our local school district or our local post office or our local hospital. It doesn't mean that at all. But that's what the right-wing worldview will bring us. It's very, very, very disheartening. Especially if you see the trends and you see the statistics and you see the numbers of how wages have really just declined over the last 30 years. So again, back to that. And you look, I don't like it either. I don't like fostering the us and them mentality. But at the end of the day, that's what it is. It's capital versus labor. It's the interests of the special interests with the big money versus us. And that's never going to change. We can delude ourselves into thinking, oh, well, you know, we're so much more superior than that. We're not. You can delude yourself into thinking, well, we don't need unions anymore. Things are so much better. It's not like the Industrial Revolution. Not accurate. Which is why now, more than ever, people need to be standing together. People need to be sticking together and calling their representatives and fighting back and running for office. I mean, I can't stress that enough. And good on Linda Small. Again, smallforpasenate.com. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Linda's name. Quick break. Right back. And the kids locked in the Capitol are fighting till the end. And we're not gonna break tonight, and we're not gonna bend. Some say the union's down, but I asked around, and everybody said, this is a union town, a union town. All down the line, this is a union town, a union town. All down the line. And if they come to strip our rights away, we'll give them hell every time. This is a union town, a union town. All down the line.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we bear.
You're listening to Win 101.5.
Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Illinois AFL-CIO President Mike Kerrigan says the lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of billions of dollars in pension cuts for Illinois public workers came only after years of efforts to negotiate a solution to the unfunded pension obligations. He says the unconstitutional theft of these earned contractually promised benefits is unacceptable.
Some of my quote use that word exactly, pension theft. So we're going to court, and we're confident this public act will be overturned.
Kerrigan says pension payments should have equal high priority to bond obligations, so workers who put in decades of work earning those pensions won't be shortchanged.
Pension payments need to have a high priority in terms of those kind of things get paid first before we have other discussions about spending money on other programs. This is an obligation as a result of contract negotiation, and they need to be honored.
Walmart workers sent an open letter to the new Walmart CEO urging him to work with Our Walmart to improve working conditions and wages for Walmart workers. They said in the letter that low pay, inadequate hours, and unpredictable scheduling isn't good for workers or for the business. And they wrote the new CEO about Barbara Collins, an 8-year employee of Walmart who was fired for speaking out about wages and working conditions. Collins had to visit 3 different food banks in 1 month to feed her family. The workers appealed to new CEO Doug McMillon to be responsive to efforts by workers to get Walmart to treat workers better.
Just because a worker is making money off of tables doesn't mean that the corporation should opt out of paying them decent wage.
Former restaurant worker Carlos Romero. Romero is high road organizer with the Restaurant Opportunities Centers in Chicago. Chicago community activists, including Stand Up Chicago, the Workers Organizing Committee of Chicago, SEIU, Action Now, and the Grassroots Collaborative this week pushed for a higher minimum wage in the city. The groups are backing a voter referendum on the March 18th ballot calling for a city minimum wage of $15 an hour. Romero says it's time that new models were adopted to end poverty wages for restaurant and other low-wage workers, and that should include paying living wages instead of tipped wages for restaurant workers.
There are multiple business models out there that show higher productivity and higher profit by taking care of their workers and by having a highly involved management style. And we offer that as an organization with Restaurant Opportunity Centers.
We stand today not because we want more money. We want justice today.
It's always the same story, even back when I started, 76. Less men, more coal. That's what they want.
I'm fighting for everyone. Everyone in my community. I live in the south side of Chicago, and it's rough. We all need to come together. Workers all around the nation.
Support Workers Independent News and keep these worker voices on the air by donating now at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Tales of American Political History with Clinton Porter Hackney.
We've been talking about how a championship boxing match and the winner's attitudes and actions changed America. Muhammad Ali continued to challenge American norms, including refusal to fight in Vietnam. He was for many years a polarizing figure, but he made us think and he made us change, whether you respect him or not. Like any other game changer, he also had good timing. He came on the scene at the beginning of the TV era when everyone could hear and see him. Ali was the first end zone dancer, the first trash talker. He freed black athletes and entertainers to be themselves and to remove boundaries. And as historian Anthony Chesborough says, the Clay-Liston fight forced white Americans to reconsider their views about blacks. Ali was a scary black man only because he was attacking the system. And that he was. This is Clinton Porter Hackney at cphackney.com.
Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Yes. What other assets do we have we can sell off? You know, they were talking about the wine and spirit shops. We got to sell off those. They wanted to sell off the lottery. Spent a couple $1 million of taxpayer money to try and do that. Because, hey, you know what? It's only the best-run lottery in the country. What could we possibly do better? Oh, yeah, privatize it so they can operate it at twice the cost and, of course, profit. And then there's the parking garages in Harrisburg and the parking authority where, you know, overnight the price of a ticket doubled. And my horror story, I got a ticket right about the time they flipped. And I paid the ticket within the 2 days. I get a letter a couple days ago saying, you owe us $20 more. We didn't bother to credit your account for, well, I think it was 2.5 weeks after. And then try to get through to these people. Try to get someone to answer the phone. And when they do, the computers are done. Sorry, can't help you. We'll call you back. And that should just be, hey, hold your breath until you pass out and die. Not going to help you. It's, you know, all of these privatization schemes, and I keep asking, what have we privatized that has actually helped we the people, that's actually been good for us? And I haven't found anything, which is why we've asked Blaine Rummel. He's senior strategist with the group In the Public Interest. InThePublicInterest.org is their website. Blaine, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick.
You know, I look at this story, and it's just one little minor pet peeve, I guess, of mine. But I can't imagine how many thousands of other people like me in this parking situation got a ticket. Hey, I got it. I'll pay it. It is what it is. But here now you're going to try and sock me for another $20 and then not even answer my questions?
Yeah, and you know, I'm sorry that you're going through that. And you're right. There are thousands of other folks going through it, and it sounds like Harrisburg's getting a little bit of the Chicago treatment. That, you know, that they privatized their parking meters, 36,000 of them back in 2009, and it's really become Exhibit A in what goes wrong when you recklessly outsource these services to for-profit corporations. Exact same thing happened there. Sudden spike in parking fees, sudden spike in penalties. And then when we actually went through and looked at that contract, it's a 75-year contract. I'm not sure how long yours is in Harrisburg, but in Chicago it's a 75-year contract, and it includes outrageous clauses like folks aren't – if citizens, taxpayers are going to hold a street fair or a parade and they're going to use those parking spaces for that, they actually got to reimburse the company that now controls the parking meters. So it's just outrageous.
We got to protect the profits, is what you're saying.
That profits come first.
Yeah. You know, fortunately, Harrisburg's only signed on with standard parking for the next decade. So maybe I just have to stay out of Harrisburg for the next decade because, look, you know, if I can't even get the sense of knowing that you're going to be fair with me, look, I admit I was over on the meter. It was over probably by 15 minutes. Paid the ticket. Now you want to suck $20 more and won't even show me the post stamp, the postmark on the envelope, which I gotta think is Exhibit A, right?
Right. And you know there was a time, you know, in this country where you could adjudicate something like that. And at least, you know, people have their gripes about the government, and some are warranted and others aren't. But you could at least have some kind of assurance that you're going to be adjudicated, that this is going to be adjudicated fairly. And no one had a real stake in it. No one had a real profit motive in making sure that you were fined and that fine should be doubled. And that simply doesn't exist in these deals. You said it just a couple minutes ago. Profit comes first. Public safety, public health, any kind of concern for the public comes second.
And, you know, I look at
this. If at all.
And I look at this, and, you know, we've got a governor here who wants to auction off whatever we've got and at fire sale prices. I mean, you know, with the wine and spirit shops, a major asset for taxpayers of this commonwealth, basically going to give it away because originally they said, oh, it would be $6 billion, and then they whittled it all the way down to $500 million. And then it was, we probably won't even get that, but, hey, it's core functions of government. We shouldn't be doing this, which is just ludicrous to me.
It is ludicrous, and you look at, you're absolutely right. You look at how well the system there has been managed in Pennsylvania, and how many dollars are invested back into local communities, into education, into public services that people rely upon on a daily basis. And for whatever reason, here is something that has worked well, where taxpayers. And government officials are accountable to taxpayers, and it has worked well. But because it is not in line with this odd fascination, with this belief that government just can't do anything right, they have to sabotage it. They have to sabotage it because it is not in line with their philosophy. And as we just said, their philosophy and those profits come first. Nothing else matters.
Let me ask you this. I've been on the air over 8 years here, and I've been asking, I ask the question often. Is there anything that we used to do for ourselves, that we the people, through our government, through our investment, that we did for ourselves, that we decided, you know what, it's just better if we put this in the hands of Wall Street, of the profiteers, and we did that, that it actually benefited us and not just a handful? Is there anything that we said, you know what, we couldn't do this. I'm sorry. We've got to give it over to these people because they're the smart people. They'll run it better.
You know, you asked me that question the last time I was on your show, and I couldn't give you an answer then, and I still can't. You know, there was something to be said for a little while for the belief that we should outsource a certain expertise or a certain expertise that maybe we don't have the in-house capacity within government to handle. And I'm talking about things like IT services or specific healthcare services. But even those, you know, things, we're hoping to see a trend in starting to, where governors, lawmakers are starting to say, well, hey, wait a minute. You know, we outsourced, we said that this expertise only exists in the private sector, and so we outsourced. We signed these big contracts, and it turns out that it ended up costing us more. And so it would actually cost less to actually start insourcing those services, yep. You know, to build the capacity within government and have public service workers provide the IT services, healthcare services. And in fact, California Governor Jerry Brown, in his budget that he has just proposed, includes language in that. And if California is taking the lead on that and saying, hey, you know what, outsourcing these services hasn't worked, we're going to start insourcing and actually building public capacity, that would be a huge turning moment.
I mean, for me, you want to talk about a failure of privatization and outsourcing. I just look at healthcare.gov. I mean, the sad reality is you had 55 for-profit corporations with their fingers in that, and nobody took the lead on it. It was, oh, my part worked, but it didn't work.
It didn't work. And it didn't work, not, you know, in part because, yeah, there were 55 contractors all trying to get their piece of the pie. And when you're trying to get your piece of the pie, again, you're not going to be focused on the public good. It didn't work for that reason. It also didn't work because we have so hollowed out government that we have not provided appropriate oversight. There's nobody in the government that could provide appropriate oversight and manage all those different contractors. And it wasn't even just at the federal level. At the federal level, CGI Federal was the largest federal contractor. They just got tossed to the side. The administration finally had enough of them, thankfully. But they had a history of these kinds of screw-ups, and they still got the contract. But it's also at the state level. You see a number of governors and state officials in Oregon, for example, coming out and really kind of laying the blame where this rightfully belongs, and that's with these contractors who, again, put their profits ahead of people's health.
So that's a step in the right direction. Are we seeing this idea taking hold in other places? You know, I've told the story a number of times. When I was in Wisconsin 3 years ago, when people were in the street, I remember taking my car to get the oil changed behind the Capitol. And there was a guy in front of me who was, his job was being outsourced. He was retiring. They were doing away with his position. He was going to retire, get his pension. But he was going to do the exact same job that he did for the state for a private contractor at twice the money. And the guy who was taking care of him behind the counter was angry that he was getting his pension, not angry at the fact that his tax dollars were going to pay twice as much to do the same job he was doing for the state.
Yeah, it is unbelievable. And, you know, fortunately, we are starting to see some states learn from these mistakes. We just yesterday praised Vermont, West Virginia, and Nebraska. Those last two states, or particularly Nebraska, you might not think that they, given as conservative as it is, that they would be talking about this, but they are. In Nebraska, there is a very strong piece of legislation that seeks to rein in reckless outsourcing. In particular, seeks to ban any contract language that guarantees a company profits. I think I was on your show once. We talked about a study that we had done of private prison contracts, state and local private prison contracts, and we found that 65% of state and local private prison contracts included language that said that the state or local government had to keep their private prison 80, 90, 100% filled, or else taxpayers had to pay for the empty bed. Essentially, heads you win, tails I lose. There was no, you know, risk for these private prison companies because they were basically writing profits into their contract. So this bill in Nebraska would ban that kind of language. In West Virginia, there is legislation to cap any contract to 5 years, and also to require that if a service is going to be privatized or outsourced, that the public, that the private workers who work for that company have fair pay and reasonable benefits equivalent to the private sector. So we're not seeing a denigration in wages, which may, you know, look like you're saving a little bit of money. But what happens is when you cut somebody's wages so far, they end up on public assistance, and that costs taxpayers even more in the end. So, and then in Vermont, right now, Massachusetts has the strongest anti-outsourcing language in the country. And Vermont, we're seeing legislation moving there that doesn't quite go that far, but it certainly does a lot of the things that Massachusetts does. And the most important thing there is they're going to make it a law, or they're looking to make it a law, that would make it easy to cancel contracts if these private companies either exceed their cost expectations or quality of the service fail.
And I think those are all good things, especially, you know, I know the president during his State of the Union said he was going to use the telephone and the pen and all of that. I think having standards in all contracting that raises wages, raises conditions, I think brings the good actors to the table, if there are any, or just says, you know what, we can't screw the workers and take the money from them, so it's probably not worth doing.
Right. Well, and we're going to be, in the public interest, we'll be coming out with a study shortly that we're going to call America's Highest Paid Government Workers. And they're not the nurses or the teachers or the firefighters that we think of when we think of government workers. They're actually the CEOs of these privatizing companies,
yeah,
who make millions a year in taxpayer dollars. And meanwhile, as they're making more and more, the way that they're cutting costs is by slashing people's wages who actually work for a living. And that is having a devastating effect, not only on those workers' wages, but in those communities. You know, I'm preaching to the choir here, but when you cut people's wages, cut people's benefits, if they have to end up on public assistance, that ends up costing a whole hell of a lot more. They don't have money to spend in the local restaurant. They don't have money to go and spend in the local theater and have a night out with the family. And that has a devastating effect. And meanwhile, you know, the CEOs of these companies, the private prison industry, the private water industry, the private online school industry, are making millions from taxpayers. And so we're going to, A, have a little fun with that, but also that's our next project, is shining a light on those folks.
Well, I look forward to seeing that. I look forward to having someone come on and talk about it. But, you know, you brought up the private water, and, you know, I look at the West Virginia catastrophe that happened there. You know, no one really talked about the fact that, you know, Freedom Industries dumped their stuff into American Water's water, which gave us Freedom Water. You got to love toxic green sludge, toxic yellow sludge that makes you vomit uncontrollably. But, you know, you look at this and you go, nobody really talked about the privatization of water. And then I got this question, and this will be the last one I've got for you. Now that we've got this polluting company and this privatized water, since it's not our water anymore, can the privatized water sue the polluting company?
That is a good question, and I think we're actually going to, yeah, I think at your suggestion, we'll look into that. That's an excellent question. Stay tuned.
All righty. I look forward to it, Blaine. It's always great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us.
You too, Rick. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Blaine Rummel, senior strategist at the group In the Public Interest. InThePublicInterest.org is the website. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
In 1897, miners at collieries throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal region had had enough. Conditions were grueling and life was difficult. Miners were frequently cheated out of pay, overcharged for supplies, some they never wanted or received, forced to live in captive company-owned towns, shop at overpriced company-owned stores, even mandated to use the company doctor since fees were deducted automatically from the miner's pay. This, combined with mine owners forcing longer unpaid hours and the anti-immigrant Campbell Act of 1897, taxing mine owners for the use of non-native labor, drove miners to strike. Spontaneously starting in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, workers marched north to get other miners to join in the struggle. Their demands were modest, a 10-cent pay raise, and a reduction in the cost of gunpowder. They also wanted the freedom to shop in non-company-owned stores of their choosing and see a doctor not owned by the coal company. As the miners moved northward toward Hazleton, mine owners, determined to crush the workers' protest, sent their company-paid police force and strikebreakers. Local law enforcement was also on the side of mine owners. Luzerne County Sheriff James Martin, a former mine foreman, deputized 102 local men, arming them with Winchester rifles and sidearms. The group of some 400 miners marching peacefully and unarmed in rows of fours moved onward toward Latimer. Stephen Urich, joining the group outside of Hazleton, taking with him the American flag, shouted, "We have nothing to worry about because we have the American flag to protect us." Within hours and a hail of Winchester bullets, Stephen Urich was gunned down in cold blood, his beloved American flag drenched in his blood and the blood of those who lay murdered and wounded. Eyewitnesses said the sheriff and his hired killers mowed the men down like grass. More than 20 men were murdered on that September day, and more than 50 were wounded, many shot in the back in Labor's forgotten massacre. The sheriff and his murderous band were tried for their part in the Latimer massacre and found not guilty of murdering 20 unarmed peaceful demonstrators. Lest we never forget, or as the wife of a miner whose life was stolen from him told her children, "You can forgive, but you can't forget." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So, you know, in the State of the Union address, the president said, in talking about, you know, inequality and poverty, he said there's some other steps we can take to help families make ends meet. He says a few are more effective at reducing inequality and helping families pull themselves up through hard work and then the earned income tax credit. He said right now it helps about half of all parents at some point. He said, but I agree with Republicans like Senator Marco Rubio that it doesn't do enough for single workers who don't have kids. He says, so let's work to strengthen the credit, reward work, and help more Americans get ahead. And look, you know, I'm a fan of the earned income tax credit. It was the brainchild of, and look, it's very few things that I'm going to say Uncle Milty had right, but Milton Friedman had this one right. If you're going to prop up a low-wage economy, you've got to make sure that people have the ability to participate in your economy. This comes out of the earned income tax credit, comes out of Milton Friedman's negative tax, which was purely meant to get money into people's pockets so they could participate in the capitalist market. Because, understand, capitalism fails when people don't have money to participate in the market. It's that simple. It doesn't get much simpler than that. So when you see the president saying, well, we're going to try and expand this and we'll see where we're going to go, good luck. Good luck with the Republican-led Congress. Because, you know, here you've got them, you know, wanting to gut a whole bunch of money out of the SNAP program. I think I said yesterday about $8 billion. A program that one out of every seven people in this country are currently using. Now, the Census Bureau's current population survey Interestingly enough, because you know when you start thinking, when you think about the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, when you think about welfare, when you think about food stamps, you're thinking about, you know, women with children. You're thinking about people in their old age. But the reality is, according to this Census Bureau survey, the group 18 to 59, they account for over half of all households acquiring food stamps in 2009. In fact, the number of college-educated workers who are collecting SNAP benefits has also gone up since 1980. They point out that almost 30% of households that receive food stamps are now led by someone with a higher education. And, you know, it takes away from that whole frame. Well, you know, it's those lazy people. It's those stupid people. Understand, if you don't have the wages to be able to put food on the table, guess what? You're going to be asking for some help. Also, they point out that college graduates are now more likely to work jobs that don't require a degree. They pay very little and are of the nature of part-time. And, you know, as we've been talking about, since this recession, which I still think was a depression, since this recession has taken so long, and they have been able to hold down the employment by making workers work twice as hard, you kind of got to go, well, you know, at some point, use the pen, use the phone, do whatever you got to do, but people need a raise. People need to make sure that, you know what, they're okay. And for me, you know, I look at this and I say, we need to be strengthening the social safety net, not destroying it. We need to be making sure that there's that helping hand there to help the small business, to help the entrepreneur. Say, you know what? I'm going to put my shingle up. I'm going to give it a shot. I'm going to try and be my own boss. And I think one of the greatest things for that, as much as I bash Obamacare, because there are certain things that I would have done differently, this was a huge step in the right direction. You know, I met a guy the other day who was saying, you know, now that he's got this, oh, I hated Obamacare, hated it. Absolutely dead set against it, wanted nothing to do with it until he found out, what? I can leave my job, get health care for my family, and follow my passion? Really? Huh. That sounds like a pretty good idea. And he's doing it. Now, we'll see what happens in the next 6-7 months. But, you know, at the end of the day, here's somebody who's saying, you know what, I'm going to follow my passion. I'm going to follow what I want to do. And isn't that what we want for everybody? To be able to make a living at something that you really enjoy, something that you know, I forget what the one old-timer told me. He says, if you really enjoy what you do, you're never going to work a day in your life. You know, and I've said it before. I've been very fortunate. I have a job that I truly love. I have jobs that I like getting up every morning thinking about. I like getting up pursuing. And I wish that for everybody, especially for my kids. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. And I suggest you go there, and if you missed any, pick it up. Also, you can email me, rick@ricksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Got to take a quick break, right back with the third hour. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show. Changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to Win
Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Illinois AFL-CIO President Mike Kerrigan says the lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of billions of dollars in pension cuts for Illinois public workers came only after years of efforts to negotiate a solution to the unfunded pension obligations. He says the unconstitutional theft of these earned contractually promised benefits is unacceptable.
Some of my quote used that word exactly, pension theft. So we're going to court, and we're confident this public act will be overturned.
Kerrigan says pension payments should have equal high priority to bond obligations, so workers who put in decades of work earning those pensions won't be shortchanged.
Pension payments need to have a high priority in terms of those kind of things get paid first before we have other discussions about spending money on other programs. This is an obligation as a result of contract negotiation, and they need to be honored.
Walmart workers sent an open letter to the new Walmart CEO urging him to work with Our Walmart to improve working conditions and wages for Walmart workers. They said in the letter that low pay, inadequate hours, and unpredictable scheduling isn't good for workers or for the business. And they wrote the new CEO about Barbara Collins, an 8-year employee of Walmart who was fired for speaking out about wages and working conditions. Collins had to visit 3 different food banks in 1 month to feed her family. The workers appealed to new CEO Doug McMillon to be responsive to efforts by workers to get Walmart to treat workers better.
Just because a worker is making money off of tables doesn't mean that the corporation should opt out of paying them decent wage.
Former restaurant worker Carlos Romero. Romero is high road organizer with the Restaurant Opportunities Centers in Chicago. Chicago community activists, including Stand Up Chicago, the Workers Organizing Committee of Chicago, SEIU, Action Now, and the Grassroots Collaborative this week pushed for a higher minimum wage in the city. The groups are backing a voter referendum on the March 18th ballot calling for a city minimum wage of $15 an hour. Romero says it's time that new models were adopted to end poverty wages for restaurant and other low-wage workers, and that should include paying living wages instead of tipped wages for restaurant workers.
There are multiple business models out there that show higher productivity and higher profit by taking care of their workers and by having a highly involved management style. And we offer that as an organization with Restaurant Opportunity Centers.
We stand today not because we want more money. We want justice today.
It's always the same story, even back when I started, 76. Less men, more coal. That's what they want.
I'm fighting for everyone. Everyone in my community. I live in the south side of Chicago, and it's rough. We all need to come together. Work is all around the nation.
Support Workers Independent News and keep these worker voices on the air by donating now at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I will oppose the Columbia Free Trade Agreement.
Now it's time to clear the way for a series of trade agreements.
You can trust me.
From the Monongahela Valley to the Mesabi Iron Range, the coal mines of Appalachia, the story's always the same. 700 tons in the middle of the day, now sir, you tell me the world's changed. Once I made you rich enough to forget my name.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Yeah, Youngstown, I mean, came up in the president's speech and everything, along with the free trade agreements that he said he wasn't going to pursue. And, you know, a lot of people were surprised that it came up in the State of the Union. Some folks thought it would have been a more central point of the discussion. Personally, I just think it's a bad direction. But here to talk to us on our Future Friday, our good friend Dave Johnson from the Campaign for America's Future. Dave, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Rick.
So I'm sure you watched the State of the Union address. I just read the transcript. Were you surprised that it was in there? Were you surprised that he even mentioned it, given all of the blowback here recently?
Well, what I think happened, I think he really damped down his push for both Fast Track, which is a congressional procedure that pushes the trade bills through, and mentioning the Trans-Pacific Partnership and others. I think he gave it a line, maybe two sentences at most, and we were expecting a large push. So I think we've been very successful in organizing enough people to understand what this is about, to push back. So I think he might be distancing himself.
Right. You know, I look at it, and, you know, he called for something of a manufacturing strategy, kind of. Very tacitly, I would say, you know, with the mentioning of Youngstown, which I guess is going to be the like the 3D printing manufacturing hub of I guess at least Ohio, if not the country, called for more of those. And as I was thinking about the trade agreements, and, you know, you're the expert on this here, wouldn't that kind of be in violation of the trade agreements as they're written to be spending money on these hubs?
Not exactly. The hub is like, call it a regional manufacturing strategy, because we can't get a national manufacturing strategy going. The Congress, you know, won't approve anything, blocks everything. And by Congress, I mean Republicans. And anyway, so the idea of a hub like this is that you get all the local community colleges and universities, you get a program to specialize in the knowledge you need to know about everything involved with the 3D printing, which is a huge coming future manufacturing technology. You get other elements. You get investors lined up. In other words, you get an ecosystem around this particular technology building up in an area. And you see this in other ways. You saw Detroit, of course, was the center of the manufacturing ecosystem.
Silicon Valley. Right.
And so you get in place the elements to actually build that industry of the future. And so, I mean, it's a really good idea. Congress, of course, would approve squat, Republicans. And so he was able to use executive power and persuasion to get this, to get some money, you know, to the local educational establishments, to get some investment going down into the area. So he's done this there. He's set up another one. I forget exactly right now what it's about. And he said he's going to do six more, but if only the Republicans in Congress would participate and cooperate in this, we could get 12 of them around the country. Now, it's not a small deal. It's a big deal. Unfortunately, then, these ideas of these trade agreements kind of counteract what he's trying to do, I think.
How so?
Well, the one side, the sell point on these trade agreements is that you increase exports from them. That's true. But the problem with the way we've been negotiating these trade agreements is that they're not done for the general benefit of trade. They call them trade agreements, but they're really something else, because trade's a small part of these things. It's really more investor rights. And the process that we've put together actually excludes what you call stakeholders. In other words, labor groups, consumer groups, environmental groups, health groups, all of these citizens groups that have an interest as stakeholders in trade are excluded, while the large multinational corporations are the ones doing the negotiating. So what you end up with is agreements that actually are only in the interest of a very small number of stakeholders, but they're very powerful. The large multinational corporations, and then they write these agreements to benefit them at the expense largely of everyone else.
Well, like that's how NAFTA. It's supposed to be, Dave. That's how it's supposed to be.
No, it does. See, trade can be a great thing, and they're giving trade a bad name here. NAFTA, now that we've had NAFTA, what is it, 20 years?
Yep.
30?
20 years of January.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm getting Alzheimer's here, so. No, but they look at the effect of NAFTA, and the overall effect now is around 1 million jobs lost and a five times increase in the trade deficit. And the trade deficit is a very big thing to learn about, because the trade deficit is the amount more that goes out of the country of money and jobs than comes in. So a fivefold increase. That's NAFTA. We don't even have to talk about what happened with China.
Right.
So here's what's going on now. So they started trying to push through this Trans-Pacific Partnership, it's called, with all of these countries around the rim of the Pacific, except China. So, and they excluded everybody but the large corporations. They kept it secret. It's a rigged process. Okay, so then they came and said, we're going to set up something called Fast Track, which is another rigged process, to try to push it through Congress before people can figure out what's going on. Remember, the whole thing's still a secret. So citizens groups and others all around the country started, wait a minute, wait just a minute. We're at a point now where all of us are feeling so strongly the effects of these past things on our economy. You know, we're all worried about jobs. The economy just isn't recovering, except for a few people who are the beneficiaries of these trade agreements. And a lot of people understand that a lot of this comes from, directly from, these trade agreements. They offshore these factories, and then they bring the same stuff back here to sell. But people here lose jobs, and the rest of the people here are told, shut up, you don't get a raise, and if you do anything about it, we'll move your job.
Yep. And here we are downward. Now. It's that downward pressure on wages that has really destroyed the standard of living in this country.
Yeah.
The mere ability of corporations to threaten holds everything down.
So everybody's feeling it. Everybody's getting it. And then they want to come and do more of it with these other trade agreements with such an obviously rigged process that I think what's happened is they overreached. They woke up a huge segment of the public, and that's just the activists so far. You know, the people that are paying attention, listening to your show and things like that are saying, wait a minute, and they're fighting back. And it's starting to look like they're not going to get this fast track approved by Congress.
And to be honest with you, Dave,
last week.
To be honest with you, Dave, I don't want any president to have fast track. I was against it when H.W. Bush wanted it. I was against it when Clinton had it. I was against it when the Shrub had it. I'm against it now that they want to give it to Obama. I think it's just a bad idea.
Yeah, it's a bad. It bypasses Congress's constitutional responsibility to carefully look over these agreements and amend them if they feel something's not right. And so the rigged process, they come out with these rigged trade agreements. They're called trade. They mean a company can sue a government for interfering with anything that makes them a profit, including tobacco companies. That's part of this.
Yeah. You won't let us sell our tobacco to your kids? We're suing.
That's exactly right. And that's exactly one of the things in the treaty, just to show how rigged this is. Then they try to push this rigged process called fast track in. So people have woke up. I think we've got enough opposition and people, we're at the right point where so many people are starting to get what's been going on in this country, that the whole process of forcing wages down and then a few people pocket that wage differential. And by the way, there's a word for it. It's called labor arbitrage. When they pit low-wage workers in these non-democracies against people here, and they take these factories around the borders of our democracy to avoid taxes, wages, regulations. And then they're allowed to bring those things back here, the goods made in those factories back here, and undercut everything we've built in this country by selling them for cheaper, putting more factories out of business, their competitors, the smaller companies. So people are waking up, and I think, I'm hoping that out of this, what we see next is that, okay, so we have this momentum. We're beating this effort by the corporations, the large corporations, by the way, and it's against smaller corporations. We're beating this effort back, and I think what could come out of this now is we take that momentum and then we go back to the president and we say, when you ran for president, you said you were going to renegotiate NAFTA. Well, then when you got in and the economy was so bad, you said it's going to have to wait. That was in February of 2009. He said, well, I'm afraid it's going to have to wait. Well, we waited, and here we are. And I think out of this momentum, we're going to get a call, a popular movement to renegotiate NAFTA, to renegotiate what we've got with China and take back control of this trade problem, I think.
I'm hoping you're right. I mean, it sounds great. I mean, you go back to 2008. When campaign Obama was running around saying workers should have the right to collectively bargain,
yeah,
and I'm going to pass the Employee Free Choice Act, and we're going to go and we're going to look at these trade deals and we're going to renegotiate the bad ones. I voted for him based on those statements.
A lot of people did.
And very quickly those things fell to the side because the corporatists, the big money donors, the people who actually run the country, they said, no, that's not going to happen. We like our trade agreements. We want more of them.
He promised, and he was right. And I think we're going to see democracy step up And the people are going to say, okay, now it's our turn to talk. I think we'll get that out of this momentum if we push for it. Just so the listeners can get something about what's happened, our trade deficit, I mentioned that earlier, that's the amount more that we buy from somewhere else than what we sell to somewhere else. Every time you hear them say, oh, good, more exports, that's good. But if there's even more imports than exports, we lose.
Yes.
The trade deficit in 2012 was $540 billion in 1 year. Goes up every year almost. It might be less this year. 2012, though, $540 billion. Now, think about this. If companies, factories, service companies, whatever, inside the United States got orders for $540 billion in 2012 for things made and done in the United States, they would have to build thousands of factories and hire millions upon millions of people. The suppliers of those factories would boom. The whole economy would have boomed in 2012. $540 billion. That's more spending than was in the whole stimulus package. And that was 1 year. The stimulus was 3 years. If $540 billion of orders came in 2012, and then another $500 billion in 2013, et cetera, et cetera, on and on, think about how the economy would be booming. Well, that is the effect on the economy of a trade deficit of that size. That is how much it is draining out of our economy from these trade agreements. That's what we're dealing with.
And it's huge. I mean, if you look at the numbers from EPI, they point out that our trade deficit just with China from 2001 to 2011 cost us 2.7 million jobs in that time frame. And
right.
You think about it, just as you pointed out, every time we buy that cheap plastic crap from China, our dollar goes to China. And if they're not buying our goods, what are they doing with it? They're buying our debt, and they're buying our companies more than anything. They're buying up these companies, they're crating them up, and they're shipping them overseas. If you remember, during the 2012 presidential election, there was a company that Romney at one point, his group had at one point had control of. They were literally shipping that company over to China.
Yeah, during the election.
Sensata, I believe, was the name of the company.
What was it?
Sensata.
That's right, Sensata in Bridgeport, Illinois. Right during the election, they were packing that factory up and shipping it out. And, that is so important to understand that this is not trade. Trade means we buy from them, they buy from us. It's not just jobs that leave when China has all these factories and everything, because when the factories leave, and, you know, how many towns you drive around, you see the old factory brick, you know, the windows are all broken, the roof's falling in. Well, the technology leaves.
Right.
The supply chain leaves. And then you can't do it anymore. We don't build computers here. We can't. We barely could build phones, and they just sold Motorola to a Chinese company. We don't build TVs. Think of all the things that we don't build. Well, we don't just lose the jobs. We lose the entire ability to build those things. It's called the ecosystem. And it goes away, okay? When that ecosystem and the supply chain, and you have to start from scratch to get it back. In other words, the ways that our country makes a living are going away because of these trade agreements.
Yeah, but Dave, it's because of all those onerous regulations. It's the job-killing EPA, don't you know? It's those labor unions, don't you know, wanting the health care and the pensions and all that.
That's called democracy. We live in a democracy, and in a democracy, the people have a say, and they say, we want good wages, we want environmental protections, and we want to be protected from being scammed on. We want to be protected from being injured at work. We want to be protected from chemicals dumped in the water. That's democracy. When they take that factory and move it over the borders of democracy to a, call it, business-friendly country like China, people don't have a say. They're told, you don't get good wages. You don't get good environmental protection. I don't know. Have you seen the pictures of what it looks like, the air in Shanghai?
Yes.
Yeah, and people are dying. The air is so bad. And so what? Because the people on the top are making billions off of it, literally. The families of people who run China now are all billionaires. So that's what they're saying. When they say there's too many regulations, what they're saying is that that pesky democracy thing you've got that says you've got to take care of the planet and the people who live here and things like that, well, we're going to move our factory across the border from that democracy.
Where there's freedom. Where there's freedom, to have.
That's right.
Where there's freedom to have freedom water, like in West Virginia, or freedom air, like they have in China. It's maddening, Dave. And I'll leave you with one fact, one little factoid, before we wrap things up. You mentioned the $540 billion trade deficit, that our country had with the rest of the world. Just with China in that 1 year of $540 billion, $315.4 billion of it was with China alone. Mm-hmm. And in fact, almost three quarters of our non-petroleum trade deficit was with the Chinese. Only $1 billion in petroleum or energy-related deficit was from that. So $314.4 billion in goods.
In one year. Yeah. That's the way to think about that. Get it again? Is that if we'd had orders from China for $314 billion, think about how we'd be doing, too. But also, think about how that would make our economy boom. That would also mean we're buying more stuff from China, so it would help their economy boom even more. See, that's what trade done right can do. That's not what happened. China didn't buy that stuff back. China stifled our economy with that strategy of theirs, and that says they're not playing an economic game with us. The game they're playing with us is not about building our economy and their economy and everybody prospering. That's not what they're doing with that.
It's about
they're
destroying us.
Yes.
Absolutely. Dave, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us. And good for you. You didn't yell or scream this time. I'm proud of you.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a mellow guy out here in California.
Dave Johnson, I appreciate the time. Great talking with you.
Dave
from the Campaign for America's Future, ourfuture.org, the website. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Let's turn now to the wide, wide, wild world of sports. The big story at this time of year, of course, is the Super Bowl. That multi-million dollar showcase of super-paid superstars, billionaire owners, taxpayer-financed sports palaces, extravagant corporate skyboxes serving deep-fried caviar, and TV ads running $4 million for a 30-second spot. But behind the scenes of this big-money sports extravaganza is a sordid secret of illegal cheating. No, not the use of steroids. Rather, this scandal is about the NFL's use and abuse of cheerleaders. Astonishingly, these glamorous, athletic, and very hard-working ladies, who bring sideline pizzazz to the show and are used by owners to promote the team brand and ticket sales, are paid less than the beer hawkers on game day, less than a McDonald's crew member, and way less than minimum wage. Yes, that's illegal, which is why some Raiderettes, the popular cheerleaders of Oakland's NFL team, have filed a lawsuit for wage theft against the owners. Overall, pro team cheerleaders get $70 to $90 per game. That's for a 12-hour game day plus uncompensated practice sessions that routinely run a grueling 6 hours and mandatory promotional appearances. The teams nickel and dime the women by shorting their hours, and they even illegally fine their pep leaders for such nonsense transgressions as bringing the wrong pom-poms to practice, and no health care for a job that puts you at constant risk of injury. And then there's this Dickensian twist. The club management withholds all cheerleader pay, as meager as it is, until the end of the season. So the women are essentially indentured servants to teams wallowing in wealth. This is Jim Hightower saying to the NFL, boo, boo.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at HightowerLowdown.org.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. You know, I look at this and so much going on. You know, it's just so much going on, especially with what happened on Tuesday. All kinds of goings on, all kinds of stuff to pay attention to. Let's go to the phone lines. Got Jake on line one. How are you doing tonight, Jake? What's on your mind?
I'm doing good, Rick. I called in to make a comment about two things, the presidential speech and then a subject that is kind of surprising to me, and that is the attempt by two state senators to legalize medical use of marijuana. Anyway, with the presidential speech, I thought the president did pretty well. I thought he approached the speech in the right, with the right demeanor. There were some Democrats that encouraged him to really go after the Republicans in some of their positions. But I think in the last couple months, especially after the Republicans, or at least the public perception was that the Republicans were responsible for shutting down the government, I believe there's been a little bit of, shall we say, coming to Jesus on some of their positions out of sheer political pragmatism. In fact, the word coming out of Washington is that the Republican leadership has realized that if they really want any chance at controlling the Senate in the upcoming elections, they cannot. They absolutely cannot allow the government to be shut down again in the upcoming debt ceiling conversation. And they, in fact, realize that they're going to have to compromise with the president. Now, given that, I think the president handled some issues very deftly. I think the best quote of the speech was that America needs a raise. I think he's absolutely correct. That was a great, great verbiage. And what he was telling the Republicans is, look, you can support this and you can do the right thing. But beyond that, I mean, the polls say by large margins, two out of three Americans say we need, you know, those on minimum wage need a raise. The polls say that better than 70% of the American people agree that those who are on unemployment deserve the unemployment extension. And beyond that, if they do that, that's actually going to be an obvious economic stimulus. So it would be a win-win-win for the Republicans. Now, on some other issues, I think the Republicans might be willing to compromise immigration. At least the leadership is talking compromise. Now, whether the Tea Party still has the clout that they once did, not so sure that the leadership on immigration, because that's a very touchy issue, especially the senators from the South. But at least the Republicans are talking compromise. So I believe the president's approach of, shall we say, reaching his hand across the aisle, I think was the right thing to do. Probably the highlight of the whole speech was when he recognized that veteran, who had an incredible 10 tours. I just can't get that to my mind. I mean, wow, 10 tours and what that man went through. I mean, he's a real American hero, but I believe what he did, he pointed out the real human cost to these wars. And I think he sent the message that, you know, maybe it's time that we get out of these wars. And he has, as you know, he's made some plans, but I think he, in a very real way, pointed to the American people, if we ever forgot the real cost of the war. So by and large, I thought the president did real well, Rick. I really haven't listened to the talking head. What's your opinion on that?
I was underwhelmed by it. I thought he could have gone much bigger. I thought there were a lot of things he could have done. I thought he, you know, it was, instead of bold steps forward, it seemed to me to be very nibbles, little pieces, bits, bits and pieces where I think it could have gone much bigger.
Well, you may be right. Any specific issues you thought that
income inequality? Income inequality. I thought he could have gone a lot further on. I think he could have made it the call of the day. For a while, up into the speech, he was talking big about, you know, hey, this is really serious stuff. He was very timid on it. The idea of increasing the minimum wage. There were things, yeah, great. You know, we're going to increase it on contracted employees. Great. I thought his comments on the education, we want to encourage teachers, the tough curriculum, blah, 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 I'm in favor of. And then he throws in that we want kids to do more than just fill in bubble tests. Well, I mean, you look at his Secretary of Education, he's Mr. Bubble Test. So, you know, there's a lot of things in there that just made me go, yeah, okay. A lot of the same stuff from last year. And, you know, if you're going to, here's my view on it. If you're going to throw things out that you know aren't going to happen, you know you've got a Republican-controlled House that's going to give you nothing, why not go much bigger? Why not, you know, start pushing the goalposts further to the side? And hopefully, you know, it's like any negotiations you've negotiated before. Mm-hmm. You throw out the big plans, and then you settle for what you had settled for. This seemed to me to be he put on the table what he was willing to settle for.
And in other words, ask for more than you think you're going to get.
Absolutely,
that does make sense.
And
I did forget one other thing. I like the fact that he said, you know, I'm gonna ensure that from now on, any federal contractor will pay at least the 10-10, at least the minimum wage. I mean, that's going to affect probably several thousand employees. That was a good step forward. But when you talk about income equality, you may be right about that. He probably could have pushed that a little bit easier. I ran into some astonishing numbers here, Rick. Income equality, there's a lot of reasons, but one of them is that the political influence of big money up in the Capitol is tremendous. And I came across some figures that even I thought astounding, and I've been involved in politics for a long time. 1% of the top 1%, which is minuscule percentage of the population, contributes 40% of the political contributions in this country.
Yep.
That is absolutely astounding. Now, we always knew that the wealthy contributed large amounts of money, but it seems even among the wealthy that wealth is just accumulating to the very, very wealthiest among us. And you know that at some point has a very negative effect on our democracy. And in fact, it seems to be getting worse, if anything. Food stamps. You know, we hear the Republicans attack food stamps. Obviously, that goes to people who need help feeding themselves and their family. And the Republicans always talk about equal sacrifice. Yet when you look at the cost to the average American, the numbers I saw, an individual makes $50,000. I don't know the exact figure of where the average income would be. My guess, Rick, would be somewhere between $45,000 and $50,000. Is that? I think that's pretty accurate.
Somewhere.
The cost to the average American for food stamps right now is about $36. If you look at the cost for someone with an income of $50,000, the cost of corporate welfare to that taxpayer is about $3,600. So when you look at it in that vein, I mean, you see the wide disparity, and they're just, you know, to go after food stamps at a time when the economy is bad and more people are in need of it, to me is just unconscionable. And that goes again to that income disparity in our country. The Republicans just had their priorities are just on the wrong side.
No, I'm with you. And this is another one of those moments where you go, I think the president could have pushed harder back. He made a couple of comments. But at the end of the day, I thought it could have been much more forceful, much, much bigger.
Mm-hmm. If I can quickly take a minute, I know we off the air we had talked about an effort up in the Hill to legalize medical marijuana. What's kind of ironic, in a sense, I kind of chuckle. The two chief sponsors are diametrically opposed in most issues. You have Dale and Leach, your buddy from Liberal Democrat from the Philadelphia area, and you have Mike Falmer, a very much conservative Republican from central Pennsylvania, and they are both the chief sponsors. They have both been passionate, and I have to give especially Mike Falmer, he's taken criticism, as you might expect, from his leadership. The governor, I think, is really basically, I don't think he wants a touchy issue, and he's using the excuse, well, I'm waiting for a report from the Food and Drug Administration. Basically, he's kind of shoving it aside. I don't think he wants to get involved in that because of the political ramifications. But I think a lot of people have the misconception, and I know I talked to Senator Falmer about it. There's misconceptions about out there that, you know, people, if it becomes legal, people are going to go around smoking doobies. Well, that's about it. According to what Senator Falmer told me, what will happen is we'll take the good part of the hemp, and they want to inject that into a, reduce it to a capsule size, and then consume that as a pill. I mean, and there have been studies, and I'm sure some people illegally have done it, that have taken these capsules. We're talking about things like post-traumatic stress disorder that have been used by soldiers to eliminate some of the huge problems that they've had. It has a very positive effect on people with epilepsy, with diabetes, and a whole range of horrible, horrible childhood diseases. And I watched the press conference that they had prior to the Senate hearings this week, and there were a bunch of parents, and most of them were there with their children. And then you had John Hanger, and you know John Hanger is the one candidate for governor who absolutely, he takes it a step further. He wants to legalize marijuana.
Yeah.
I don't think you're going to see that.
No, I don't
now.
Either.
I don't think.
But I'm going to push back on the Falmer point, because I'm actually looking at the law that they're proposing, and that it is Senate Bill Senate Bill 1182,
okay.
And it actually says in there there are certain places where you can't smoke cannabis. There are places the vaporizers and other things. So this idea that it's just a pill, I think he probably should read the law. It's only 34 pages. There are numerous points in there where it says where you can and you can't smoke it. It's interesting that's what he picked up on. You gotta wonder. I'm in favor of the medical uses of it. I'm in favor of if it's gonna help alleviate people's pain and suffering, I'm all in favor of it. But putting it on the shelves next to the Tic Tacs, can't go there. Bottom line, that's the end of it. For me, anyway. I got to take a quick break here, Brett, Jack, because I got to get to my next guest. But please, call back again.
All right, thanks.
Thanks, man. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Right. The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
All right, welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So the news reports all day today, some white powder being delivered to some hotels in Rutherford, New Jersey, just outside of the stadium where the Super Bowl will be played in a couple of days, well, Sunday. So somebody, some smart aleck, decided, hey, we're gonna send cornstarch, because early reports are that it's cornstarch. And, you know, for me, you find who did it and you beat them. Beat them within an inch of their lives. And then make them eat cornstarch. Amazing stuff. Anyway, let's find out what's going on in the big city, around the country, and around the globe. Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service. Luke, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, always a pleasure.
I understand you have bailed out of the Big Apple. I don't blame you.
It was not of my choosing, but I'm happy to be away from the mess there. You know, it always surprises me. You know, you turn on Drudge today, I'm sure you'll see some headlines saying war games or something with an ominous New York City skyline and then the Super Bowl logo, as if every year it's some sort of surprise that in order to keep people safe at the Super Bowl, they're going to bring in tanks or snipers. There's all this panic every year around this event. It's become a cyclical nuisance in my eyes. So it's just another debacle, it sounds like, with that cornstarch.
Yeah, I'm of the mindset that, you know, all of this stuff is just to give us the illusion that we're somewhat safe. And, you know, if we just wake up to the reality that, look, you're never going to be completely safe, and sometimes, you know what, you just got to take a chance. And
hey, there was a video last year that I'm sure you can find online, and maybe you talked about it, of a guy who just put on one of those GoPro cameras on his hat, didn't have any lanyards or tickets, and filmed himself walking out of his hotel room in New Orleans and walking through the underbelly of the Superdome there and getting right onto some of the VIP seats within the Super Bowl during, while the game was being played. So it is proof that, you know, if you walk around confidently enough, you can, you know, find a way to finagle access even to these most secure events. So there are always, you know, vulnerabilities even within a $1 billion security operation.
Yeah, I mean, I've got friends who have done that in the past, and it's all in the attitude. If you act like you belong there and like you own the place, you know, I had a friend of mine who was a good petty thief for a while until he got caught, and he said it was just, you know, he would walk in and walk out with arms full of stuff.
It
was amazing to me.
Hey, confidence is king.
Until he got caught, and then, well, and then he got what he deserved, but, you know.
Yeah.
Just is what it is. So you're leaving the big city then. You're not going to be there for the Super Bowl. I understand this is the cheapest ticket in probably 20 years to go to the Super Bowl.
Maybe that's true. I looked on StubHub the other day. I think they sent me a marketing email, and it is quite funny that the NFL is so protective of its copyright over the Super Bowl name that for any sort of ticket sales, they all refer to it as the big game.
Yeah.
And you almost sort of don't know exactly if you're buying a ticket for the Super Bowl, I guess, but the most expensive ticket was just shy of $1 million, and I guess you'd be, you know, paying cash and meeting someone for a $1 million ticket transaction, which seems like a fool's mission to me. But yeah, maybe that's interesting that it's gone down in price. I guess not every one is willing to tough out the cold.
$1 million? Do you get to sit in the huddle?
You're in. You think so? You're in like an executive box, and it was only for one ticket too. So that's one lonely dude willing to pay $1 million and beat up somewhere in New Jersey to do that transaction.
Do you get to make get to call a couple plays or something?
I don't think so. It seemed like a really raw deal in my eyes.
$1 million. If you've got $1 million to throw away on watching a game you can see on TV for free, you have too much money.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one.
Maybe we need to be taking some of that and putting it towards education. Maybe your education.
Hey, I'd appreciate that. I'm done now. But
no, not yours. Not you. Not you personally.
Oh,
the guy,
oh.
the idiot buying the $1 million ticket.
Yeah. Well, hey, I think whoever goes in for that is going to need an evaluation of some sort.
Yeah, I guess the weather's going to break a little bit. It's supposed to be like in the 40s, I guess.
Yeah, I'm surprised. The polar vortex round two seems to have abated, so it's going to be a more mild experience for everyone, and there's no shame in that. I think the fun is it being an outdoor game to begin with, so there was some potential, I think, for it to become a truly historic if they had snow flurries. So I guess it's not a question yet, but a more mild forecast than originally thought.
Well, Well, here's the thing. As a Broncos fan, I wanted to see it be a little milder, the passing game, get that going. If I didn't care who was in it, I would want it to be like 400 below to where they're breathing and the breath just freezes in front of them.
Hey, you know, another one of those snowballs. Hey, I'm with you. I'm rooting for Denver in this one. I'm of the mindset that if my team, the Patriots, loses to anyone, it better be the best team in the land.
There you go.
So I was hoping the Broncos would have that advantage with the winter weather, but maybe they'll be more in Seattle temperatures, so it'll be a fair match.
Yeah, it should be interesting either way. Personally, I picked both teams at the beginning of the year, and I despise Seattle because their coach just after what he did to USC, I just can't stomach it.
Hey, I'm with you. So I am out of the city. But as a programming note and of interest to your listeners, I will be heading to the Ukraine tomorrow to cover the widespread insurrection of the people against their government.
The big game.
I couldn't find any more ways to travel through dangerous areas, I am not only making a quick stop over in New York tomorrow, but then flying to Moscow, in fact, to the same airport and spending at least an hour in the same transit zone where Mr. Snowden was camped out last year. So really on a world tour of global hotspots this weekend.
Where is Snowden right now? I mean he's not Tom Hanks in the hanging out in the airport terminal. Where is he, do you know?
They haven't really said. It's funny. You'd think he'd be out in the countryside, but I bet they're able to give him more protection or anonymity in the city. So who knows where he is? He is not in the transit terminal, though, so I will not be able to get the exclusive interview that I've been hoping for so long.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, if he's, if you saw the movie, and I forget the name of it, where Tom Hanks was stuck without a country and they wouldn't let him out of the airport. It was kind of a dumb movie, but I kind of pictured that. So why are you going to the Ukraine? Do you not have enough adrenaline junkie in you just to stay in New York? You got to go out of the country for it?
Yeah, no, I've been watching this one for a long time. We've covered obviously the countries that are still in turmoil after the Arab Spring and where there's some prospect of democratic transition. And then this Ukraine story popped up in November, and it captured my attention not only because I was just a few hundred miles away in Poland a few weeks before the protests began, but I do think there is this interesting narrative there of the western half of the country being very close to Eurozone countries and seeing what the benefits of that kind of economic integration are, culturally Ukrainian, whereas in the eastern parts of the country, Moscow exerts a much stronger influence. And there it's a culturally Russian part of the country, Russian-speaking, as opposed to Ukrainian-speaking in the West. And it's just been amazing to watch this president try and deal with over the course of 2.5 months, these protests, and the story of the last week is that after
he's sick,
least,
right?
No, he is now sick, which has raised some speculation that he's following a redo of the Gorbachev announcing he's on sick leave, when in fact his own ministers were, doing a coup against him. That maybe this is him stepping out of the spotlight, preparing to come back in a few days with some sort of big announcement. I don't think he's going to step down, but he will probably formulate a plan to try to restore order of some sort. So I think it's an interesting time to be there. The opposition has thus far turned down every set of overtures from the president, including an amnesty offer for all those protesters who have been arrested, which number over 1,200 at this point. But that's the conditional offer. Protesters who occupy government buildings in many of the districts of Ukraine now. They've literally just stormed into ministries and have people camped out there as the police sit by and sort of just watch as this happens. They rejected it because they would have to get out of those buildings. They'd have to evacuate their ownership of the government buildings in order for the amnesty to go into effect. So, successive offers from the president for political compromise, if you want to call it that, have been turned down. And now we're in this sort of volatile stalemate in which the opposition has to choose what its next move is. And at the same time, the president is sending more and more special forces and police officers from around the country into the Capitol, where we will be arriving. So very uncertain what the next week or 8 days, which is the length of our coverage there, is going to bring.
So we'll be able to talk to you while you're there?
That's the plan, though. We've got a number of arrangements on the ground. We've figured out ways of securing Internet access and phone connections. So we will certainly be joining you. I will be traveling with Zach Badorf again, so I'm sure you'll speak to him also. And I very much look forward to calling in and giving your listeners updates about this.
Yeah, I look forward to that. I mean, do you think it'll be as dangerous as, you know, Jordan and all of that where you guys were over the summer?
I think it's considerably more dangerous. There have been over 100 incidents of journalists being targeted, journalists being shot at by the police with rubber bullets. More and more common, though, is not even official uniformed police officers doing that, but some of the 4,000 sort of hired hands in the city that go around on mopeds and use batons to attack people with cameras and this sort. So we've stocked up. One of the reasons I'm calling you in the car right now is that I just went to a government contracting facility near the New Hampshire border and got some level 4 body armor. I'm about to go buy some helmets and the like. So we're preparing for whatever may come. There could be a crackdown on protesters. There have been evacuations of some hotels where there's some speculation that opposition members are staying. So we're going to go be very careful here. And as far as I know, this is much more dangerous than Jordan, where we were pretty much assured and we're very confident in the fact that the government didn't want anything to happen to foreign visitors. Whereas here in Ukraine, or not here, but in Ukraine, it's a very different story, where there's a great deal of suspicion about anyone who's coming in for precisely the reasons that we will be.
I got to tell you, don't take this the wrong way, but I think you're the face of what they meant by young and dumb. let me be the one that rushes into where the chaos is, where they're shooting people, where they're beating them with sticks. Yeah, let me be the guy that jumps right to the front of that line. How much do they pay you?
I think I would say enough. This is going to be a very wild trip, one that I'm confident will go well.
I got to be honest, probably in my 20s, I would have been more than happy to jump into the middle of that as well. And I envy you, actually, to be able to be right there in the face of what is history. I guess you were up the New Hampshire border there. I had an opportunity to see a debate between D'Souza and Ayers. How'd that go?
Yes, that's right. The college Republicans at good old Dartmouth sponsored this debate. They invited Dinesh D'Souza, the filmmaker of that anti-Obama film 2016, to debate The Weather Underground. Still airs last night on the topic of what is so good about America. And it wasn't really a debate. Phil Ayers was very inclined to lecture. He is a professor of education now at the University of Illinois. He talked for a little while. They didn't really even speak to each other. I was pretty underwhelmed by this event, but I could boil down their two positions into Mr. Ayers saying that America is great because of the risks taken by America's radicals. I think he would probably include himself in that group, as well as many other people that he named. And then Mr. D'Souza essentially saying that going historical on everyone and talking about Confucian China and Ibn Khaldun, the medieval Muslim philosopher, and saying that so many societies through history have treated the merchant as an effeminate figure and someone who doesn't come into their wealth in any fashionable way, whereas the aristocrat or the priest or the person with inherited wealth is somehow noble. He essentially said it's the opposite. America turned the tides on that. They uprooted the totem pole, and here the merchant and the entrepreneur is considered the strongest person. And Bill Ayers criticized his historical reading, said he was very selective in choosing his examples he pulled from. So I was sort of left with that old CNN crossfire reaction after watching one of those episodes, where simply having a pundit from the extreme right and the extreme left that debate each other for 20 minutes doesn't lead to any sort of enlightenment or revelation in the sort of lost world of political analysis. So I think they were pretty much talking at each other and not really having a dialogue of much value, unfortunately.
Yeah, kind of a waste of time. I thought D'Souza was going to jail.
Oh, well, yeah, I did ask him about that. He posted bond to get out of the charges brought against him in Manhattan federal court. But now he's out on bond. He also had to surrender his travel documents in order to leave New York City. He said he's going to fight the charges. He implied that they were politically motivated, which I was surprised he told me, because you would have thought his legal team would have really briefed him on this and said, don't even engage with the media when they ask you these types of questions. So I will have the full story written up, including his quotes, later today, and maybe his words will be used against him in a court of law someday soon.
Nice. Luke, be careful. Be careful.
I will do, and I will be sure to find a way to find my way onto your airways next week and let your listeners know what's going on.
I look forward to it. Luke Vargas, Talk Radio News Service, thanks so much.
Take care, Rick.
Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
Yeah. You're looking for experience. You're looking for someone with a proven track record. With the climate change about man-made global warming in this country. And everybody rushed to say, oh, we need to do something now about this huge problem. I didn't change. I stood tall and said,
this is the end.
This climate science of man-made global warming was not climate science. It was political science.
This is the end. My only friend, the end of our elaborate.
Yeah, one of my favorite quotes of Tricky Ricky Santorum. I got to be honest, you know, admitting I got my head in the sand, admitting you're never going to change my mind. It's never going to happen. I know everything, and you obviously know nothing. it just is what it is. I hope you've enjoyed the program, and I'd appreciate you being here. I appreciate all the feedback, a bunch of emails I didn't get to, and I apologize. It happens. You know, one of these things, you get tied up in the moment, and yeah. But I do answer all emails personally. And you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. I do appreciate the input, the thoughts, the comments. If you missed any portion of the program, rickssmithshow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. Also, we're working on getting the Stitcher app back up and running. A couple of little things going on with all the changes here at the program. Brett has moved on, my producer, going to California. I wish him nothing but the best as he moves on into the next phase of his life, and appreciate all the work that he did here for us at the program. Again, wishing him nothing but the absolute best. We'll see you back here. We'll see you back here next week. Stick around.
Been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickssmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at therickssmithshow.com. Until next time, this is and The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the Buddha's sway. Imperial, mysterious, and